alleged illicit affair and a lot of horses.
If you've got, say, 3,000 horses, how much poo do you think they would produce?
Join me, Greg Jenner, and my guests for You're Dead to Me, part of Norman Day on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. That's tomorrow afternoon at 4.
This is BBC Radio 4. Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 2nd of September. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan.
Good morning. The headlines. The US and Iran have exchanged strikes again, with 5 Iranian civilians reported to have died when shrapnel hit a wedding celebration. The Alzheimer's Society is calling for a national target for dementia diagnosis after families said they sometimes had to wait months or even years. We'll hear from a family who's had one such agonising wait just before 8 o'clock on the show.
Also in today's programme...
We now come to Prime Minister's statement, Andy Burnham.
As Andy Burnham gears up for his first Prime Minister's questions, do soaring borrowing costs already spell trouble for the new Prime Minister? We'll hear from the high-altitude photographer who's using his skills with a drone to join the dangerous rescue effort in Nepal.
Everything is difficult here right now. We have risks of like the river rising every time we enter into a tunnel. It's very risky right now for everyone, all the rescuers that are working here, for us, everyone.
And as we bring out our autumn wardrobes, spare a thought for these guys. We'll find out why a new coat is a lifeline for a Humboldt penguin. The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
Iran says it's launched drones and missiles at US bases across the Middle East as the two sides exchanged a further round of strikes. The Iranian Red Crescent said that one American attack last night hit a home that was hosting a wedding celebration, killing 5 people and wounding dozens more. The Pentagon said it was aware of the reports but denied targeting civilians. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
US Central Command said the latest attacks were in response to Tehran trying to hit commercial ships and American forces in the region. It said its targets included air defense sites, radar systems and maritime assets. But Iranian state media reported that civilian sites on Iran's southern coast had also been bombed, with a child among those killed at a wedding ceremony in Sirik County, which lies on the Strait of Hormuz. The US military said it was aware of the reports, but that it never targeted civilians. Iran struck back at US military bases in several countries, with reports of missile and drone interceptions. Tehran again warned that it would stop oil from being exported from the Gulf, despite a threat from President Trump to hit at a much harder and higher level, and Washington preparing to impose new economic sanctions.
President Putin has given an upbeat assessment of Russia's military campaign against Ukraine, saying he believes the Ukrainians will, as he put it, keep crumbling. But he also acknowledged that Kyiv's attacks inside Russia had inflicted damage. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned commercial airlines that Russian skies are now completely unsafe because of his country's drone attacks, comments which Mr. Putin called state terrorism. Dozens of Labour MPs have backed proposed changes to the government's plans to tighten the rules on political donations. Legislation, which will also extend to the right to vote to 16 and 17-year-olds, returns to the Commons today. A total ban on overseas donations is one of the amendments that has significant support, as our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports.
This legislation seeks to lower the voting age to 16 for parliamentary elections, but also cap donations from anyone living outside the UK at £100,000 a year and stop any made in cryptocurrency. Dame Emily Thornbury, who chairs the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, says that's not strong enough and has tabled an amendment banning all foreign donations, while another Labour MP, Stella Creasy, is proposing a cap on donations from UK residents, which could be £100,000 a year, but with an exemption for trades unions. Andy Burnham, who has expressed support for a cap in the past, told her in the Commons yesterday that he did think the government needed to go further, but had an open mind about what that might involve.
Hundreds of families say they've had to wait months or even years for a dementia diagnosis for a loved one, and that the delay has affected their work, finances and mental health. More than 1,000 families took part in a survey for the Alzheimer's Society, with many saying earlier action and treatment would have helped them. The charity is calling for a national standard so that anyone referred for a dementia assessment receives an accurate diagnosis within 18 weeks. The chief executive of the Alzheimer's Society is Michelle Dyson.
The shocking thing is that there is not a single target that applies to the NHS for dementia. There are targets for so many things. The Department of Health writes out to the NHS system across the country and says, these are the targets we're going to hold you to account on. There is not currently a single target on dementia. What we're asking for is that there should be a target on dementia, as there is for other conditions.
There's been a sharp rise in the number of children going to A&E in England with mental health problems. Figures obtained by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health show a 36% increase over 7 years, with the biggest rise among children aged 6 to 9. MPs will look at the issue this morning. Our health correspondent Sophie Hutchinson reports.
In 2019, A&E staff in England saw 55,000 children with a mental health problem. Last year, an extra 20,000 came forward, and there was a 62% rise in 6 to 9-year-olds needing help. The figures show growing numbers of children waiting more than 12 hours to be seen. The Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health urged the government to improve mental health services. The Department of Health says it's planning how to help young people earlier so fewer need emergency care.
The United Nations says the response to the devastating floods in Nepal is entering a new phase focused on relief and recovery. More than 1,000 bodies have been recovered. Almost 4,000 people remain unaccounted for. Research has shown that a urine test taken at home is able to detect more than 9 out of 10 cases of bladder cancer. The study, published in European Urology Oncology and led by the University of Birmingham, involved nearly 1,000 patients at 7 hospitals in England and Scotland. It's hoped the success could eventually reduce the number of patients needing invasive procedures. And the consumer organisation Which? Says a fake listing for number 10 Downing Street has exposed security failures on the travel website Booking.com. The watchdog was able to book a bogus stay at the address. The company says it uses a range of checks to prevent fraud. Here's our technology reporter, Shona McCallum.
Researchers advertise number 10 as a one-bedroom apartment in central London. In just 20 minutes, 14 people requested a stay. Which also sent a payments link through Booking.com's messaging system, which says it wasn't flagged or removed. The listing was eventually removed more than 2 months after it was uploaded. Booking.com says the limited test did not reflect normal use and that some fraud controls weren't triggered because the property was mainly closed to bookings.
That was our technology reporter, Shona McCallum.
Alan, thanks very much. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's get the latest on the weather, shall we? Chris Fawkes is at the BBC Weather Centre for us. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, Emma. And for many of us today, it's going to be pretty cloudy. We've got weather fronts as well, bringing the threat of rain, particularly to central portions of the UK. Now, for England and Wales, we've already got some rain moving in across parts of Wales and northwest England. The rain quite steady and increasingly heavy here through the morning into the early afternoon. Across southwest England, a chance of a few patches of drizzle, but across easternmost areas of England, through East Anglia and the southeast, we've got some broken cloud and some spells of sunshine for a time this morning before it generally turns a bit cloudier. Now, by the time we get to the afternoon, we've still got some rain pushing in across northwest England, affecting the North Midlands, northeast England too. But across Wales and southwest England, any rain here will tend to be light and patchy in nature, and it will probably stay dry through the day across parts of southeast England, with still occasional brighter spells coming through the cloud. For Northern Ireland, a lot of low cloud this morning, some mist and fog patches over high ground, and we've got outbreaks of rain. Now, the rain will gradually pull northwards through the day. We could still see a few patches around into the afternoon, but equally, a few brighter spells are possible here. In Scotland, we're looking at a bright or sunny start to the day across northern areas, where it's quite a chilly morning, temperatures down into low single figures. In the south of Scotland, though, different story, a lot of cloud. We've got outbreaks of light, patchy rain here. But as we go through the day, More general rain is going to spread into southern Scotland. We'll probably reach the central lowlands as we head into the afternoon. The north of Scotland staying dry and bright. Our temperatures today, well, 17 to 20 for Scotland and Northern Ireland. England and Wales, 20 to 23 Celsius. Tomorrow, overall, a little bit more in the way of sunshine to go around, but still the threat of some rain across the northwest of the UK. That's the latest.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. 9 minutes past six. Let's have a first look at this morning's papers and website headlines, most of which focus on Andy Burnham's first appearance in the Commons as Prime Minister yesterday. The Daily Mail calls him a messiah without a mandate and says that since he blamed the country's problems on Thatcher and Brexit, it's no wonder the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch mocked the Prime Minister for living in the past. And the Daily Express agrees, warning that Mr Burnham wants to take Britain back to the 1970s.
Fresh Start versus Farage Farce is the headline in the Daily Mirror, which was quite hard to say, actually. It leads with a combination of Mr Burnham promising to make the next decade better than the last and Mr Farage being sworn in on his return to Parliament after that Clacton by-election.
The financial markets have turned on Mr Burnham, according to the Daily Telegraph, which says a market rout overshadowed his address to MPs. The Financial Times says, with government borrowing costs now the highest since the 2008 financial crisis, pressure has been piled on the Prime Minister and the Chancellor ahead of this autumn's budget. And it's worth saying we're going to get into that in some detail at 10 past eight.
Elsewhere, the Times reports that police did not tell the families of the victims of the Nottingham attacks that they were being stalked by a mentally ill man. The paper says he travelled to Somerset to find the parents of Barnaby Webber and attended a GP surgery where Grace O'Malley Kumar's father worked. Nottinghamshire Police has referred itself to the police watchdog and said it will not be commenting during the investigation.
The Eye picks up on a report from the US that scientists could have found dark matter on Earth for the first time. It sounds like quite a big deal, doesn't it? It says a team in South Dakota using a tank of liquid xenon buried a mile underground might have detected a WIMP, a weakly interacting massive particle. Do you know that's what? Did you know that's what WIMP stands for?
It's not what I've called.
No, that's not. I thought WIMP meant something else. Which is thought, by the way, this weakly interacting massive particle to be the key to dark matter.
Trips off the tongue. And yep. Ever fancied getting a better look at your teeth while you brush them? You now can. That's according to The Guardian. It reviews Dyson's latest toothbrush, which will offer you, gosh, a live stream of the inside of your mouth while you clean. But the paper warns it will come at a cost. £419, to be precise, to get that toothbrush.
Wonderful. 11 minutes past six.
More than 6 months. That's how long nearly half of the people seeking help for possible dementia wait for a diagnosis. And while they wait, as their loved ones suffer with all types of distressing and difficult symptoms, they live in limbo. This insight comes courtesy of a survey by the Alzheimer's Society, which wants everyone to receive a diagnosis, care plan and access to treatment within 18 weeks of a GP's referral. Dominic Hughes is our health correspondent. Dominic, why so long? Is it the same over across the UK? What can we learn from this?
Yeah, I think there are lots of different things going on at the same time. To start with, there is increased demand on the system, an ageing population. More people are living with dementia, and we know that there is that extra demand on the system. We also know that there is a shortage of old age psychiatry posts that are filled in parts of the UK. There are lots of vacancies. The Royal College of Psychiatrists estimate roughly 29% of posts across the UK are vacant or rely on temporary locum staff. And we spoke to a guy called Keith Andrews, whose wife Sue needed an assessment. She got the test really quickly, but when they were waiting to see the psychiatrist who was going to confirm the diagnosis, they moved back through the waiting list. The waiting list just got longer and longer and longer. And in the end, when it got to a year and Keith and Sue had been living with the uncertainty around that for a year, they decided to go private and got a diagnosis very quickly. Now, that's important. The diagnosis is really important because it opens up then access to services and support that the families up until that point find it very difficult to access. So it makes a huge difference for the families.
Yes. And I suppose in that time, what are you meant to be, you know, doing? What are people doing? How are they coping?
Well, this is the problem, is that families say that without the diagnosis, once they get that diagnosis, it makes a lot of different aspects of life easier. They have a greater understanding of the symptoms and behaviour. They can support the person who's living with dementia better. They get access to information. They can speak to healthcare professionals. But also they sort of know what's coming. And, you know, it's a very difficult disease to both live with, but also to look after someone who has the disease. So it just provides that extra support. Keith was saying to me that when he was waiting for Susan's diagnosis, her condition was just getting worse and worse and worse. And it was a time that still lives with him, and his own health was affected. We spoke to another family. The son had to give up work because he was caring for his father. So it has a financial impact as well. And it affects the entire family. So it's very difficult.
Well, we're going to be hearing from Keith Andrews, who's from Bournemouth. You mentioned there his wife, Susan, who's living with mixed dementia and Alzheimer's disease a bit later on in the programme, to make sure that we do hear from those who have been struggling with this and these weights. Dominic Hughes, our health correspondent, thanks for putting us in the picture.
14 minutes past six, the death toll in Nepal has officially hit 1,000, but it will inevitably rise and much further. More than 3,900 people remain missing. More than 600 of those are workers thought to be trapped in a vast network of mud-filled tunnels at hydropower sites along the Trishuli River. Let's speak to Laura Bicker, our China correspondent. Laura, morning. Just give us the latest from the Chinese side of the border first, Laura, and then we'll turn to Nepal.
Well, first of all, 550 people, around that number, still remain missing. We know very little about the victims there. We know very little new information. What we've heard from Chinese state media this morning is that massive numbers of rescue teams have managed to clear the road to Geerong Port. Remember, that is the main border between Tibet and Nepal that was completely washed away in those floods. In fact, the only thing left standing that we can see on Chinese state media is the concrete base of a water tower. They've already been combing the area for the last 4 days, they tell us, but now with more than 2,000 personnel on site, they say they can accelerate that process and use more life detecting equipment to see if there are any signs of survivors.
And meanwhile, Laura, what are the Nepalese saying about the state of what must be, as you describe, one of the most awful and grim clear up operations in history?
Well, yes, when it comes to those hydropower tunnels, that effort still continues. And you mentioned there a number of the missing, potentially in the hundreds, were working in those vast network of tunnels at those hydropower sites along the river. Engineers have pumped air into these tunnels. They're using controlled explosions to clear the debris at the entrance. The Nepalese army say they're focused on these search and rescue efforts, and they're also being deployed to collect bodies and prevent the spread of disease. And when it comes to that, the United Nations have said that the response to the floods in Nepal is entering a new phase of what they call relief and recovery. The priority they say now is to ensure that the thousands that have been left homeless get the humanitarian aid that they need. The biggest challenge, they say, is still access to affected areas. Now, you can see from these massive V-shaped valleys, huge mountains where this absolute torrent of mud and rock came flying through. It's been very difficult to access various areas, and many families are still relying on helicopter flights for food and aid. Specialist teams from China and India are joining the efforts, and they're trying to build new bridges over what has become a torrent of a river. So those rescue efforts to get to those survivors are still ongoing.
Okay, Laura, thank you. Laura Bicker, our China correspondent.
Now, it's 17 minutes past six. Let's turn to the cost of government borrowing. It's risen sharply. The UK is now paying some of the highest rates it's faced in decades. Here's Leanna Byrne with the business news. Leanna, morning.
Morning, Emma. Morning, Amal. So, yes, this is part of a global sell-off in government bonds, and Britain has been particularly badly hit. So the yield for the UK's benchmark 10-year government bond, that's the return the investor gets for lending money to the government, that rose as high as 5.26% yesterday, and that's as high as since 2008. Jason Borber-Sheen is co-head of income strategies at the asset manager 91 and joins us now. Jason, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
So let's start with the basics. Why are government borrowing costs suddenly rising so sharply around the world?
Sure. Well, I think if we put it perhaps in simple terms, so if you imagine that if I asked to borrow from you for 10 years, the two factors you'd probably want to understand about me best would be how creditworthy I am, and then whether you could do something better with that money for that 10-year period. And each day, because a bond investor does that, there's a reappraisal of those two factors. And I think the straightforward answer is that both have been getting worse. So the creditworthiness of most developed nations has been questioned, whether that's about fiscal or the amount of debt issuance. And then in terms of the, is there a better opportunity for your money? Then factors such as the AI principle and the performance of other assets. And one of the reasons why bonds themselves are demanding a higher compensation for the amount of risk they hold is that growth and inflation both look to be higher this year than they were at the start.
So why has the UK been hit particularly hard?
I think the UK tends to have taken on a higher sensitivity to certainly the first factor. And fiscally and financially, it looks in a worse situation than it has been for many decades. And so there is this heightened movement by UK bonds to those factors. But the other is that actually UK growth, whilst not very dependent on the new drivers of internet and AI, has actually appeared to look quite strong despite the conflict. So it does have a great sensitivity to commodity prices, given the natural gas price move on the back of the conflict. That has not helped bond yields. But actually UK growth itself, despite the move up in expectations for interest rates, has actually held up.
Now, if these borrowing costs stay at these levels, what does that mean for the Chancellor and the budget that's coming in the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it does get harder. So the headroom that there is to stay within the fiscal rules that have been set, and there is a meaningful importance attached to that by bond investors in the UK, reduces with much higher bond yields. What we know so far is not great in terms of the detail on policy, but we do expect the new Chancellor to provide a pretty orthodox statement in the budget and to also be very adherent towards the fiscal rules. We don't have enough information to say too much on that yet, though.
Now, speaking to the BBC overnight, one of the Prime Minister's key advisers, Lord Jim O'Neill, says the government could bring borrowing costs down by tackling things like the state pension triple lock, welfare spending. Would measures like that actually make a significant difference to bond investors?
I think they certainly would. So the interest expense that comes from, for example, a pension knock and the message that would go along with that would be meaningful. The political appetite, though, for that sort of magnitude of change has not been there over the last few premierships. It would certainly, though, provide some security to bondholders.
All right. Jason Borbershin, co-head of income strategies at the asset manager 91. Thank you so much for joining us. With me now, Freddie Cahoon, investment director at JM Finn. Now, something, Freddie, that really plays into all of this is oil prices, isn't it? And oil prices have climbed again this morning. Brent crude is around $95.50 a barrel. So what are markets most worried about with oil around that level?
Yeah, exactly, Liana. They've been steadily rising again from the low 80s up to the mid $90 a barrel level today, as you say. I think the deepest, the greatest concern actually is in the diesel and heating oil market. Diesel rose 7% yesterday. It's the tightest part of the oil complex at the moment with very low inventories. And obviously we've got the winter months ahead. And we're going to have a big build-up of inventory to ensure that we get enough heating oil and diesel through the winter months. And obviously, that they will all, these prices will feed straight into transport costs, into agriculture, and into logistics businesses, adding cost to businesses.
Mm. Now, today we have U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright. He's in Venezuela today, and he's expected to sign a major oil agreement. And the Trump administration is very much presenting Venezuela as part of the answer to the oil issue. But how much extra oil could Venezuela actually bring into the market?
Well, it really depends on what deal that they announce here. But ultimately, it seems as if the U.S. is acquiring many billion dollars of barrels of oil off Venezuela. Obviously, that will help supply. It just is a question of how quickly it can get through into the system and what the actual impact on the oil price will be.
Mm, so when Donald Trump says this could help lower gasoline prices for Americans, is that actually realistic before the midterm elections in November?
I think it's going to be tricky ahead of the midterms from where we're looking at today. I noticed that he spoke to a lot of refining companies yesterday to try and get prices down as well. But it's a very tough task, I would suggest.
Now, Freddie, a quick question on you for you about UK listed companies, UK merger and acquisitions. Some UK listed companies are set to disappear from the stock exchange. So a UK industrials group, Bodycote, says it's agreed a $1.8 billion takeover from a US private equity group. Veritas, one of many. So how many London firms are being bought here? Do you think they're undervalued?
Well, it certainly appears so. I mean, private equity have been having a big feast this year on a number of UK well-known UK companies. I think we're up to about £135 billion worth of deals already signed in 2026. And Bodycote is just another example of a potentially undervalued company. The share price that Veritas are going to be paying is only back to where they were trading in 2021. So arguably, yes, Bodycote has been undervalued for some time, but also other bids that we've seen include EasyJet, Segro, which is a property logistics business, and a global testing business called Intertek Group in the FTSE 100, are all being bought by private equity firms to suggest there is undervaluation in the UK market.
Okay, Freddie Cahoon, Investment Director at JM Finn, thank you so much for joining us. Now, the boom in artificial intelligence isn't just creating huge demand for electricity and computer chips, it's also increasing demand for the minerals needed to build all that technology. So lithium, cobalt and rare earth elements are used in everything from data centres to batteries and advanced computing equipment. And a new report from the UK's Critical Minerals Intelligence Centre says Britain needs to do more to secure those supply chains. The government estimates will need at least three times as much AI-capable data centre capacity by 2030. Dr. Holly Elliott is a minerals geoscientist and author of a new paper from the Critical Minerals Intelligence Centre, which looks at the supply chain needs of the UK's AI data centre and quantum build-out. So, Holly, good morning.
Could easily have messed that one up. You messed the short forehand up, though.
Hello, Dr. Holly. Oh, we don't have Dr. Holly there. Do we still have Freddie Cahoon? Hello, Dr. Holly.
Can you hear me?
Hello. Yes, I can hear you. Brilliant. Hey. Great to hear you. Right, Dr. Holly, what is the problem with the way we get those materials at the moment?
So essentially, we're currently in the age of the digital revolution, and that means that quantum computers are moving from things like theoretical concepts. We're increasingly using artificial intelligence in our everyday lives, and all of those aspects require data. They require data centers, and that means there is a growing demand for these technologies. And essentially, the raw materials that we need for these data centers and these technologies is also increasing as well. But actually, in terms of the critical minerals that we need, those things that you just identified, the supply chains for them are currently quite juvenile. Many of them have been highlighted as critical minerals in the recent UK criticality assessment. And that means that there is quite a high risk of supply disruption, and there's quite a high risk of the potential impact if that supply disruption does occur. And that could be economic, that could be social, and that could be defence as well. And these technologies, they're becoming much more complicated. We need a much greater variety of elements in them that we've never really actually needed before. And that means that the supply chains for these elements, they're not very well established, they're young, we might only source them from one or two countries. And that means that the supply disruption can have a huge impact if there is a disruption. And that means that also if one country completely monopolizes the market, there's huge aspects of geopolitics. They can actually control the price and the availability of these elements as well. And actually, these trace elements, the weird and the wonderful, like tellurium, bismuth, hafnium, for example, they're not produced from a separate tellurium mine, for example. They're actually produced as byproducts of other commodities. So for example, tellurium or selenium, they're actually extracted and processed during the process of copper. We actually recover them as a byproduct. And that means that we can't really respond to demand as well. We have to use the copper demand in order to actually get the amounts that we need. And that means that actually there's a huge amount of competition for these critical minerals. And as we need the increasing amounts of these critical minerals for data centers, we're also needing very similar amounts and quantities and also the types of elements for mm-hmm. a huge amount of other sectors. So we're talking things like aerospace, renewable energy, electric vehicles, even our mobile phones are all requiring a very mm-hmm. similar group of minerals and metals. So there's a huge okay. amount of competition there.
All right. Dr. Holly Elliott, thank you so much for joining us.
Leanna, thank you very much indeed. 29 minutes past six, time to say good morning to Jonathan Lejard, who's got the sport.
Morning again, or just morning to everyone.
We'll go with that.
Yep, good. we're going to go to New York, actually. We'll have some details of the record-breaking summer transfer deadline in a minute, but we're going to go to New York because the top seed in the men's singles at the US Open tennis, Alexander Verrett, is battling to stay in the tournament. Correspondent Russell Fuller is watching his match against the Italian Lorenzo Sogono, now into a fifth set.
Yes, Jonathan, and it's the world number 89 from Italy who's trying to become the first man to beat the men's top seed in the first round of a Grand Slam since Ivo Karlovic beat Leighton Hewitt at Wimbledon in 2003. And he was 2 points away from victory in the fourth set, but Zverev, who won the French Open and was a Wimbledon runner-up, won that fourth set 7-5. And so at 1:30 in the morning, we're into a fifth set. They've been playing nearly 4.5 hours, but Zverev has just broken for a 3-2 lead after a Sonego double fault. So he may yet win, but it's not over yet. And remember, this men's draw is already devoid of the injured Jannik Sinner and the beaten Novak Djokovic.
And also Arthur Ferry, who lost on his US Open debut.
Yes, after the high of Wimbledon, where he reached the semi-finals, he lost 6-3, 6-3, 7-5, admittedly to the 13th seed Lorenzo Musetti. He didn't play particularly well, Arthur Ferry. He didn't serve well. He made 43 unforced errors and had little preparation for this US Open. And that was his choice because he chose to play on the tour in Winston-Salem last week. And it was a very profitable week because he reached the final. But this was his first appearance in New York as a senior. And I think probably the lack of preparation was a contributing factor as he lost in straight sets, Jonathan.
Thank you, Russell. More from Russell in an hour. Let's see whether Zverev can get through. The 2023 champion Coco Gauff is through to round two. So is the world number two, Elena Rybakina. Here, Premier League clubs have broken their all-time summer transfer record. Again, between them, their spending reached £3.46 billion. The biggest deal involved the Argentina midfielder Enzo Fernandez moving from Chelsea to Manchester City, a joint record British transfer fee of £125 million. That took City spending to £458 million, a new Premier League record for a single transfer window. We're going to make your eyes water a bit more later in the programme when we dissect who's spent what. One other line for you. The England women won their first one-day international cricket against Ireland by 6 wickets after a record chase of 282 in Leicester. Opener Maya Bushio scored 104 off 95 balls as England made their highest ever chase in the format.
Jonathan, thank you. We'll be talking more, as you say, a bit later on. But looking ahead now to Saturday evening on Radio 4, I can tell you, I think we'll need this by the end of school week beginning again for lots of us. Motherhood and comedy are going to be colliding.
Mums everywhere, beware.
We're turning the spotlight on you.
My mother's 10 out of 10 on the hysteria scale.
My mother and I are too similar for our own mental health.
Your mum is back with celebs spilling the beans on the funny side of motherhood.
Hello.
Here we go.
Kicking off the new series with comedians Sarah Baron and Nish Kumar.
At my 40th birthday, my mother kept going up to groups of strangers, not introducing herself and saying, all those stretch marks and for what? Nothing.
Join me, Laura Smith, for the new series of Your Mum. On Saturday night from 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now the time is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amal Rajan. Here is a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Iran says it's launched a fresh wave of drones and missiles at US bases across the Middle East as the two sides exchange another round of strikes. The Iranian Red Crescent says 5 people, including a child, were killed in one US attack in southern Iran. US Central Command insists civilians were not targeted. The military in Jordan said it had intercepted 13 ballistic missiles from Iran, while Kuwait also said it was responding to attacks. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has given an upbeat assessment of his country's war in Ukraine, saying he expects Ukrainian forces to keep crumbling. But Mr. Putin acknowledged that the Ukrainian drone attacks inside Russia had caused damage. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned commercial airlines that Russian airspace is now completely unsafe because of Ukrainian drone attacks. President Putin has accused Germany of fabricating evidence to blame Moscow for an attempted drone attack at Leipzig airport last month. Germany has announced the closure of Russia's consulate in Bonn. Russian officials have dismissed the allegations as baseless and absurd. Hundreds of families say they've waited months or even years for a dementia diagnosis for a loved one, with the delays affecting their work, finances and mental health. The Alzheimer's Society is calling for a national standard so anyone referred by their GP receives an accurate diagnosis within 18 weeks. The man accused of murdering the American conservative activist Charlie Kirk last year has appeared in court and pleaded not guilty. A judge in the state of Utah has ruled that 31-year-old Tyler Robinson should face trial on an aggravated murder charge, meaning prosecutors can seek the death penalty. And research has shown that a urine test taken at home is able to detect more than 9 out of 10 cases of bladder cancer. The study, published in European Urology Oncology and led by the University of Birmingham, involved nearly 1,000 patients at 7 hospitals in England and Scotland. It's hoped the success could eventually reduce the number of patients needing invasive procedures.
Alan, thanks very much. 26 minutes to seven, that back to school feeling continues. Having made his first Commons appearance as Prime Minister yesterday on September the 1st, Andy Burnham's now limbering up for his first Prime Minister's questions. And the questions he's facing both in Parliament and outside are getting trickier, not least now a spike in bond prices and how rather they will affect his first budget in October. Henry Zeffman's here, our chief political correspondent. Morning, Henry.
Good morning.
Andy Burnham, you know, came in promising people some breathing space, but the bond markets are making his life more difficult. Tell us a bit more how he's going to handle that or not, we think.
Yeah, long-term borrowing costs in the UK at a 28-year high. It's a global trend, but it is one to which the UK is especially exposed. Well, in that marathon appearance in the House of Commons yesterday, and I really mean marathon because for Andy Burnham it lasted nearly 3.5 hours. Some people run a marathon in less time than that.
Yeah.
And Andy Burnham did say at one point that the bedrock of his government will be fiscal responsibility. I think all the signs from that and from other public comments that John Healey, the new Chancellor, has made in recent weeks are that the budget on October the 28th was already intended to be slightly more restrained than some people might have expected from some of the things that Andy Burnham has said over recent months and years, with then more of that change of direction being brought about in a spending review next year. I think these borrowing costs and the issues therein perhaps only amplify that trend, but there will be concern among some of the Labour MPs who backed Andy Burnham becoming Prime Minister because they wanted a change of direction as well as a change of style, that this might mean that he isn't as transformational a figure as he made clear in the House of Commons yesterday he intends to be.
Just talking about comparisons, though, with how things are or versus how things people thought they were going to be, we're going to have a direct comparison now between Kemi Badenoch and Andy Burnham, aren't we, at PMQs, in terms of their style. And, you know, she's been doing this some time now and what that will mean for him.
Yeah, style and substance, because I think you saw in the House of Commons yesterday in their exchanges that there is a very clear and open on both sides philosophical difference between them. Andy Burnham laid out the argument yesterday that he's made before, and I'm sure we'll hear him make again, that Britain's problems stem from a series of wrong turns in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher, privatisation, deindustrialisation, then amplified in the last decade by Brexit. Kemi Badenoch thinks that is not the case. She emphasised instead that Britain's particular current problems stem from too much public spending as well as other issues. And I think that is an argument that we'll see play out much more briefly in the House of Commons today at his first session of Prime Minister's questions, but I'm sure for weeks, months, years probably to come.
Henry Zeffman, we'll come back to this. Our chief political correspondent, thank you.
23 minutes to 7, President Putin has accused Germany of planting evidence to blame Russia for an attempted drone attack last month at Leipzig airport. The German Interior Minister, Alexander Dobrindt, said agents acting on behalf of Moscow had targeted a Ukrainian plane. And last night, President Putin gave a lengthy press conference that Frank Gardner, our security correspondent, was across. Frank, morning. What did we learn, if anything, last night from Mr. Putin about this drone attack and the war of words that is now escalating between Germany and Russia?
Well, it's a fairly predictable denial, Amal, from President Putin. And I tell you what it reminds me of very much is Russia's response to the Salisbury Novichok poisoning in 2018, when Russia came up with reportedly a total of 28 different explanations, even accusing Theresa May at the time, the Prime Minister, that she might have been involved, that it was Britain had done it itself, it was a chemical experiment, etc. So Russia is saying this absolutely isn't us. Just to be clear, what we're referring to here is the presence of three explosive drones that were discovered on or near Leipzig Halle Airport, which is a big cargo hub in eastern Germany through which a lot of equipment for Ukraine is channeled. And what was targeted was Antonov Airlines, which is Ukraine's cargo line of planes. Luckily, the detonators didn't work and the drones didn't go off. But if they had, it would have been pretty spectacular. And initially, Germany, they didn't really respond. They said, well, you know, these are just hybrid attacks, but we're looking into it. But the police have now done their investigation, and Germany's interior minister, Alexander Dobrindt, has said that this is clearly a low-level agent acting for the Russian state. President Putin has given a lengthy speech saying, look, this is all about Germany's own domestic political problems. Chancellor Merz is in trouble. He might be losing power. There's complete turmoil in Germany. This is just an effort to confuse and obfuscate. Now, the one thing I would say here, Emil, is yes, there are a lot of indications that there are hybrid war kind of sub-threshold attacks going on in Europe, whether they are cyber or sabotage, arson, and so on. But let's not forget Nord Stream. When those two pipelines were blown up in the Baltic, everybody, probably including myself, we all thought, well, this has got to be Russia doing this. And it turns out that actually Ukrainians were involved, not necessarily the Ukrainian state, but there are Ukrainian nationals who are the suspects for this.
Frank, our security correspondent, thank you very much indeed. We'll return to this story at 7:30.
It's 20 minutes to 7 now. Tehran has launched missile and drone attacks at US targets in Jordan, Kuwait, Iraq and Bahrain overnight after American forces resumed strikes against Iran on Tuesday. Yolande Nell is the BBC Middle East correspondent. Bring us up to speed, Yolande.
Well, this does appear to be turning into a serious military escalation. We just had confirmation from Bahrain that it's been intercepting Iranian aerial attacks. Also, Jordan, Kuwait, northern Iraq, all of them host US military bases and all have been targeted as part of Iran's response to the latest US strikes. Iran actually claims that it killed a large number of service personnel in Jordan, but the initial reports from US officials are that there were no casualties there. Now, this comes after there were explosions reported across the southern Iranian sort of coastal areas, including the port of Bandar Abbas late last night, Keshem Island in the Strait of Hormuz, with the US Central Command saying that it was targeting radar and air defences, mine laying capabilities. But there are also these reports of civilian targets being hit, a civilian airport, a factory, a house with a wedding going on where a small child was among those killed and dozens of people injured, according to a state official. And from both sides, you can see that the reports that we're getting are of stronger attacks than were seen following that exchange of fire at the weekend. That was the first exchange of fire that there had been between the US and Iran that we know about since July. And this comes after attacks were also reported on Monday on two tankers leaving the Strait of Hormuz. There's been an overall effect of pushing up global energy prices. They went up more than $4 a barrel yesterday to reach a five-week high. I was just looking at the price of a barrel of Brent crude a short time ago. This international benchmark for oil, it was up to close to $100, $96 a barrel.
And does this, in terms of when you were talking about the rise in and the escalations here, does this return signal a return to all-out war? Is it now
Do we think piecemeal as this is happening? What sense do we have?
Well, Washington had been indicating that it was switching to economic sanctions rather than military pressure on Iran. It was going for a kind of campaign of financial isolation. That has not brought about any sign of change in the position of Iran. And you see some strong rhetoric now coming from both sides, with Iran's Revolutionary Guards threatening crushing and devastating blows to the US, threatening to tighten the lock on the Strait of Hormuz. You know, you've had President Trump speaking in an interview with Fox News, playing down the prospects of another ceasefire, really, you know, after that memorandum of understanding between the US and Iran fell apart quickly after it was signed in June. He said, "I think an agreement with them isn't worth the paper that it's written on. We've given them a lot of chances." The Iranians, though, through the president, Masoud Pezeshkian, he was speaking yesterday before the latest strikes, and he indicated that Iran was ready to return to that interim ceasefire deal if Washington did the same.
Yelan Now, our Middle East correspondent. Thank you.
17 minutes to 7, as Henry Zeffman was saying. Parliament's return after the summer break was dominated by Andy Burnham's first appearance in the Commons as Prime Minister. And it was a session which, as Henry was saying, and now Susan Hume will say, tested not only his politics, but his stamina. Here she is.
As the Prime Minister waited in the wings for his Commons debut in the job, his Education Secretary, Lucy Pyle, seemed quite nervous for him as she plucked some bits of fluff off the back of his jacket. His Foreign Secretary, Ed Miliband, gave him a little hug in passing. Most Prime Ministers can get some recent practice in before their first stint of questioning in the Commons, but Andy Burnham hasn't had to do this for years. And his statement had to cover a lot of ground, from Ukraine to post-16 education and a promise to cheer us up.
It is my intention to bring back a bit more optimism around the country, to give people the feeling that things can be fixed. That's my style, to face things and fix things.
Well, he felt things had needed some fixing for 40 years. To jeers from the Conservatives, he said the country had taken a series of wrong turns since the 1980s, with centralisation, privatisation and austerity, all made worse by Brexit. He'd seen it during his time away as Manchester Mayor.
I say this with confidence. I do. I do. Let me explain why. Because it is backed by a decade of personal experience turning around one of the UK's former industrial heartlands and turning it into the fastest growing city region in the country, booking the low growth trend.
So he promised to unlock positivity and bring back hope for the whole country. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, wondered if he really had a serious plan for government.
He has been in office for 43 days, during which I have learned about how he puts the milk in his tea. Yeah. I have found out exactly what he thinks about pork scratchings, but I have not had the pleasure of asking him any questions.
For example, did the Chancellor, the former Defence Secretary, still want to spend more on the military?
Will he provide the funding which his own Chancellor said was necessary to keep British troops safe? And that means 3% by the end of this decade.
Andy Burnham answered smoothly.
I appointed this Chancellor of the Exchequer precisely because of his commitment to the defence of our realm and the arguments he has made.
Although he didn't get into figures or dates, simply saying that John Healey would set it all out in his spending review. The Lib Dem leader, Sir Ed Davey, also thought the country had taken some wrong turns, with power in the wrong hands.
Too much power in the hands of social media barons who interfere in our politics. Crypto billionaires who use donations to buy influence. And too little power in the hands of our people. Britain's political system too often rewards corruption and leaves everyone else feeling powerless.
Andy Burnham rather agreed and offered to work with Ed Davey on rewiring politics. The Commons' newest MP, Nigel Farage, had taken his seat at the start of business following his by-election re-win. The Reform UK leader did bob up and down for a question but wasn't called early enough, so the job fell in the end to his deputy, Richard Tice, who asked about energy bills.
It's madness to import gas from overseas when we've got our own gas in the North Sea. So when will the Prime Minister do the right thing, approve the licences at Rosebank and Jackdaw and elsewhere in the North Sea.
But pointing to our superheated summer, the Green Party's Westminster leader Ellie Chowns called for the exact opposite.
Will he rule out Rosebank and Jackdaw because the climate damage that they would create hugely outweighed any possible benefit and will lead to more disasters like we've seen on the Nepal-Tibet border just last week? Yeah.
The Prime Minister still hasn't announced a decision on the oil and gas fields, but he was hoping for a middle way.
I think the wrong approach here is to be one or the other. We're going to have to find a way to make a transition from oil and gas to a renewable future. And that doesn't mean it's all one or all the other.
Andy Burnham had to leap up and down for nearly 3.5 hours answering, I'm told, 125 questions from MPs. He's back answering more at noon today, showing that a successful Prime Minister must not only have strong policies, but strong knees.
Susan Hume reporting there.
It's 12 minutes to 7. The United Nations Food Agency warned yesterday that funding cuts mean it's being forced to slash the number of aid recipients in the West Bank in half, with dreadful consequences. And the World Food Programme said it would be reducing the number of people it reaches with food aid in the territory from roughly 400,000 to roughly 200,000. Sean Hughes, the World Food Programme Country Director for Palestine, has come into the studio and kindly joined us. Sean, thank you for coming in to see us. Let's just start with a broad context, because people won't know necessarily all the details. What is the situation on the ground in Gaza and the West Bank right now?
Well, thanks very much for having me. I can tell you, having visited Gaza several times in the last 6 months, that when you are there, it does not feel like a ceasefire. Despite a ceasefire coming into effect in October last year, airstrikes are a regular daily occurrence. They impact on our operations as humanitarians. Just last week, our warehouses were impacted by airstrikes close by. But more importantly, it means that civilians are not safe in Gaza. The second thing you notice when you are there is simply the level of destruction. I mean, you can drive for miles without seeing an intact building. And therefore, you have this sort of situation of overcrowding, where a population of 2 million people is now crowded onto 30% of the Gaza Strip.
And what of the West Bank?
The West Bank, over the last year, we've seen a rapid escalation in the level of settler violence, in the level of demolitions, and the level of displacement. And over time, this is now bleeding into food insecurity. So traditionally, you wouldn't think of the West Bank as a food crisis. It's certainly a human rights crisis and a protection of civilians crisis. But now this is coming into food insecurity, and there's now 900,000 people across the West Bank that are food insecure. That's a doubling in 2 years. So humanitarian assistance is really becoming a lifeline for people, and we're having to reduce that right at the time when we should be scaling up.
So just tell us about this warning this week from the UN Food Agency about the funding cuts. What does this mean in practice for the ability of people like you, the World Food Programme, to do what you want to do?
Yeah, well, we'll be reducing assistance. And I think this is, you know, a slight exception to many other humanitarian crises in the world, something of a new phenomenon, because donors and the political profile and the media attention on Gaza, on Palestine, has been very high. But what we're seeing now, as we come into the third year of this crisis, is that funding starting to drop off. And that makes a real difference to the number of people that we can reach. So as you noted, in the West Bank, where we've been reaching 400,000 people a month, predominantly with cash transfers, cash in their pockets so they can buy food, we're going to have to reduce that this month to 200,000. And similarly, in Gaza, there are now 75,000 families that will not receive the same level of cash transfers that they used to. And come October, we'll be removing 500,000 people from food aid distributions. And that's going to have a massive impact, again, right at the time when that kind of assistance needs to be sustained.
In order to sustain it, what needs to happen? What do you need?
We always say in Palestine, you need mainly two things. You need the funding, and you also need the access. And of course, there are continued access challenges with regard to providing assistance. The flow of goods into particularly the territory of Gaza, both from a humanitarian and a commercial perspective needs to be protected, and not just things like food. We're talking about shelter, we're talking about healthcare, prosthetic limbs even cannot enter the territory. The engine oil and the fuel that humanitarians and the private sector needs to flourish. But we also need the commitment of our international partners, of our donors, to see this through until there is an opportunity for people to rebuild their livelihoods. The humanitarian response will be a critical lifeline, and people just can't turn away at this time.
And do you feel you're getting the support you want and need from the British government?
I think the British government's been very generous. Palestine is a humanitarian crisis amongst a few that that has been prioritised by the British government amidst a declining aid budget, which sort of needs to be recognised. You know, all my encouragement, and I'll be here speaking with MPs in Parliament and with officials at the FCDO to encourage them to sustain that commitment and scale it up going forwards.
Sean Hughes, World Food Programme Country Director for Palestine. Thank you for coming in to see us.
Thank you for having me.
7 minutes to 7. We know that the main source of funding for the royal family, the core element of the sovereign grant, is rising to just under £100 million annually, with the extra money being used to pay for the upkeep of historic buildings such as Buckingham Palace, to strengthen cybersecurity at the royal residences, and to support a transition to green energy, for instance, with £11 million earmarked to replace boilers at Windsor Castle. The Chancellor introduced the legislation for the new funding yesterday, but the campaign group Republic is calling for the grant to be scrapped. I'm joined now by the chief executive of that campaign group, Graham Smith. Republic has, it says, over 140,000 registered supporters. Morning, Graham.
Good morning.
What's your objection to this? Because, of course, you object to the monarchy existing, so it's probably not a surprise you don't want this increase.
Well, I think the part of the reason why we object to it is because it is secretive and it is abusive of public funds. And this, there is no comparable arrangement in government spending similar to the sovereign grant. It is a completely madcap scheme which was invented by George Osborne, where the amount simply goes up because of the profits of the Crown Estate. It doesn't come from those profits, it comes from the public purse. But, you know, it was 31 million in 2011. Only 2 years ago, it's 51.8 million, the core funding. And all of a sudden, it's 100 million pounds.
But we know it's going to drop, don't we? Because we knew about this. Just the context is important. No, it will fall by 25% over the next year because it was temporary funding for the resurfacing for Buckingham Palace. That's ending.
It's going to fall. The total grant is going to fall from £132 million, but it's not going to fall back to the £50 million, where the core funding was. So the core funding was £51.8 million just 2 years ago, and now they're going to say it's going to be £100 million. And there is simply no justification for this. If you look at the Irish president, who does a very similar role, it's about £4-5 million a year. There simply isn't any reason.
I don't
why
think anybody's coming to. I don't not. You know, no disrespect to an Irish president, but no one's coming to visit. You know, to have tourism around the Irish president per se in the same way, are they? Or do they carry out the same level of public service and engagements?
Well,
argue.
They do. Yes. I mean, there's only one. You know, we have one head of state. We have 365 days in the year. We do not need to spend £100 million for that person to go around cutting ribbons and making speeches.
Well, that's not what it's on, though. You're fusing things. We're talking about buildings, we're talking about green energy, we're talking about whole renovations of Buckingham Palace, which is one of the most popular tourist sites.
No, it isn't.
In terms of when you can go to a state opening of rooms for overseas, people would want to go, and we'll have to see how popular it is as it opens up more, won't we?
No, because but Buckingham Palace is somewhere in the region of number 80 in the list of popular tourist attractions. It's not even close to being one of the most popular ones. Windsor Castle is number 22 and Windsor Legoland is number 11. You know,
it's pretty high up, and Buckingham Palace is only open for a few weeks of the year, isn't it?
But there's no evidence that it was, you know, the tourism argument is completely bogus. I mean, I've sat down with the heads of Visit Britain some time ago and they said, look, there's no evidence we would get rid of this. But the tourism would still be there if we weren't spending £100 million on these people. Now, the actual total cost, if you put all the other costs together which aren't included in the sovereign grant, the total cost to the public is somewhere in the region of £500 million. because there's an awful lot that isn't covered by the grant. So this is an incredibly expensive institution, and it's expensive because it's secretive, because people are not willing to challenge it, because politicians bend over backwards to accede to their demands, and they aren't willing to take proper steps.
Well, a Treasury spokesperson said the grant, which funds official business, doesn't provide any income to members of the royal family, will fall by over 25% next year as the temporary funding for the resurfacing of Buckingham Palace ends. The settlement is evidence-based and reflects an increase in core activities like state visits and overseas trips, which we didn't have time to get onto, the soft power of that. If I may finish the statement, sorry, this supports government objectives and the UK's position on the world stage.
£100 million does not, is not necessary for what is a few occasional trips overseas and a few occasional trips around the country.
We're going to have to leave it there. Graham Smith, Chief Executive of the Campaign Group Republic.
Ever feel like you just missed out on something amazing? With BBC Sounds, you can ask most smart speakers to go back to the start of the show. Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart, so you never miss a thing again.
Coming up next, Friday Night Comedy.
Get more from your smart speaker with BBC Sounds.
Let's get the latest on the weather. Chris Fawkes is here.
Thanks a lot, Emma. And we've got a rather cloudy day coming up today with outbreaks of rain, particularly affecting central portions of the UK. Now, for England and Wales, bright start to the day across parts of East Anglia and South East England with some early morning sunshine. But in the west, we've already got some thick cloud bringing a bit of drizzle, low clouds, some mist and fog for South West England. Heavy rain for Wales pushing in at times to the North and West Midlands and North West England. As we go through the day, this zone of heavier rain is going to extend northward, so turning wet across all of Northern Ireland, the rain getting in across all of Northern England and pushing on into central and at times southern areas of Scotland, seeing some quite wet weather as well, especially as we head into the afternoon. But that still leaves the far north of Scotland, where it should stay dry and bright with some sunny spells. And through the afternoon, even though the worst of the rain will pass through Wales, it will probably still be rather cloudy with a threat of an odd patch of rain, a few brighter spells, a similar story across parts of southwest England and Northern Ireland as well. So overall, a lot of cloud around, rain for some of us, and temperatures today around 17 to 20 for Scotland and Northern Ireland, England and Wales between 20 and 23 Celsius. Ridge of high pressure brings more of us a dry start to the day tomorrow with more in the way of sunshine, but rain returns to Northern Ireland, Northern England and Scotland late in the day.
Chris, thanks very much. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 2nd of September. Good to be with you. The headlines today. The US and Iran have exchanged more airstrikes. The Iranian Red Crescent says 5 civilians, including a child, were killed. The Alzheimer's Society is calling for a national target for dementia diagnosis after families said they sometimes had to wait months or even years. We'll hear from a family in limbo before 8 o'clock. And Andy Burnham is being urged to respond to high government borrowing costs by ending the pensions triple lock. More on that with Chris Mason coming up at 7:10. But also still to come, a war of words between Russia and Germany as President Putin denies using drones to attack Leipzig airport. We'll be decoding this response with our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, at 7:30. And we'll be hearing from the high-altitude photographer and filmmaker who's been using his skills with a drone to join the dangerous rescue effort in Nepal.
Everything is difficult here right now. We have risks of like the river rising every time we enter into a tunnel. It's very risky right now for everyone, all the rescuers that are working here, for us, everyone.
It's extraordinary. And as we think about potentially bringing out our autumn wardrobes, spare a thought for these guys. Humboldt penguin. We'll be finding out why a new coat is a lifeline for those penguins and what's been going on in terms of human activity to make it so. But first, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
Tehran says it launched a fresh wave of drones and missiles at US bases in Jordan and Iraq in response to American airstrikes in southern Iran. The Iranian Red Crescent reported that one US attack last night hit a home that was hosting a wedding, killing 5 people and wounding dozens more. The Pentagon said it was aware of the reports but denied targeting civilians. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
US Central Command said the latest attacks were in response to Tehran trying to hit commercial ships and American forces in the region. It said its targets included air defense sites, radar systems, and maritime assets. But Iranian state media reported that civilian sites on Iran's southern coast had also been bombed, with a child among those killed at a wedding ceremony in Sirik County, which lies on the Strait of Hormuz. The US military said it was aware of the reports, but that it never targeted civilians. Iran struck back at US military bases in several countries, with reports of missile and drone interceptions. Tehran again warned that it would stop oil from being exported from the Gulf, despite a threat from President Trump to hit at a much harder and higher level, and Washington preparing to impose new economic sanctions.
President Zelensky has warned international airlines and insurers about using Russian airspace amid an escalation in Ukrainian drone attacks. In his nightly address, he said the skies over Russia were becoming unsafe for civilian aviation. President Putin has responded by accusing Ukraine of resorting to state terrorism. From Kyiv, our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports.
Many airlines no longer fly to or over Russia, but some still do. And President Zelensky's warning was aimed directly at them. He said Ukraine was not threatening civilian aviation, but he said his country had a right to strike Russian military and economic targets in self-defense. And international airlines and their insurers must now consider Russian airspace to be completely unsafe and effectively closed. Drone-infested skies, he said, were no place for civilian aviation. At a summit in Kyrgyzstan, President Putin accused Ukraine of state terrorism. But he admitted drone attacks had inflicted damage on Russia and 10% of its oil refineries had yet to be repaired.
President Putin has accused Germany of fabricating evidence to blame Moscow for an attempted drone attack at Leipzig airport last month. Germany has announced the closure of Russia's consulate in Bonn and the Russian Cultural Center in Berlin in retaliation. Russian officials have dismissed the allegations as baseless and absurd. A former minister with close ties to Andy Burnham has said that recent rises in the cost of government borrowing will force Labour to deal with pensions and welfare. Lord O'Neill, who was Mr Burnham's economics adviser as he entered Downing Street, reiterated his calls for an end to the triple lock, which guarantees the state pension rises each year in line with either inflation, wage growth, or 2.5%, whichever is the highest. Our economics editor Faisal Islam reports.
Market rates for long-term government borrowing have risen around the world in recent days. For the UK yesterday, they were at their highest level since 1998. Lord O'Neill said the turmoil, while driven mostly by US factors, was proving pretty troublesome for the Prime Minister and would affect his agenda.
It's going to force his own political party and hopefully the whole Whitehall system to get real about dealing with some of the things that are out there that no political figures ever seem to want to deal with, such as the triple lock, excessive spending on welfare.
The government has reaffirmed its manifesto commitment to protect the annual uprating to pensions. Jim O'Neill has long opposed the policy and said the government should include proposals to reduce excessive spending as part of the PM's 10-year plan expected after the budget. The rise in market interest rates threatens to wipe out about half of the government's room for manoeuvre around its borrowing target, meaning there might need to be £12 to £13 billion in tax rises or spending cuts at the budget.
Hundreds of families say they have had to wait months or even years for a dementia diagnosis for a loved one, which has affected their work, finances and mental health. The Alzheimer's Society is calling for a national standard so that anyone referred by their GP for a dementia assessment receives an accurate diagnosis within 18 weeks. The charity says that would bring dementia care in line with other major health conditions, including cancer. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes reports.
A survey of more than 1,000 families and carers carried out for the Alzheimer's Society revealed that nearly half the people living with dementia waited more than 6 months for an accurate diagnosis after first visiting a GP. The carers report the delay affects their work, makes it harder to plan for the future, and increases the financial pressures that families face. The charity is calling for an 18-week target for patients to be diagnosed after a GP referral and to be given a care plan and appropriate treatment. 9 out of 10 families surveyed said that a formal diagnosis made at least one aspect of life easier, including understanding symptoms and behaviour, supporting the person living with dementia, accessing information, or speaking to healthcare professionals.
The man accused of murdering the American conservative activist Charlie Kirk last year has appeared in court and pleaded not guilty. The judge in the state of Utah said 31-year-old Tyler Robinson should face trial on aggravated murder charges, meaning prosecutors can seek the death penalty. Charlie Kirk was shot dead as he took part in a public debate on a university campus. The United Nations says its response to last week's flash floods in Nepal is now focused on relief and recovery rather than rescue. Nearly 4,000 people are still missing and over 1,000 bodies have been found. Search teams are still looking for survivors trapped in tunnels in hydroelectric power stations. Chinese state media reports that round-the-clock repair work is also underway in Tibet, as our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
Rescuers using heavy machinery have been working around the clock to reopen the route to the Geelong border crossing between Nepal and Tibet, which was torn apart in last week's catastrophic flood. They've now cleared the road of debris, and with thousands of personnel in the area, the search for the more than 500 people missing will be accelerated, says Chinese state media. The United Nations says the response to the floods is entering a new phase of relief and recovery, and the priority now is to ensure that the 1,000 left homeless receive humanitarian assistance. The biggest challenge is still access to affected areas, and many families are still relying on helicopter flights for food and aid.
Research has shown that a urine test taken at home is able to detect more than 9 out of 10 cases of bladder cancer. The study, published in European Urology Oncology and led by the University of Birmingham, involved nearly 1,000 patients at 7 hospitals in England and Scotland. It's hoped the success could eventually reduce the number of patients needing invasive procedures. Here's our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
The standard method for diagnosing bladder cancer is a cystoscopy, in which a camera is inserted through the urethra. This NHS trial found that a urine test identified 92% of bladder cancer cases, and it was able to rule out the disease with almost 100% accuracy. The test is being used by some NHS hospitals, but isn't replacing cystoscopies. If a larger trial is successful, thousands of patients could be spared the more invasive procedure.
That was our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
Alan, thanks very much. It's 9 minutes past seven. The back-to-school feeling continues, possibly literally in your house, as you might be scrambling for children's uniforms, and maybe some semblance of a September routine is coming into view after that very hot summer for most of us. For Andy Burnham, it's his first Prime Minister's Questions today, coming straight off his first marathon appearance yesterday in the House of Commons as Prime Minister. But it's not an easy return. After the row over the early release of prisoners, the cost of government borrowing has risen sharply, complicating Mr. Burnham's promise to give us all some breathing space. Chris Mason, our political editor, is back, and I hope you've got your pencils sharpened and we're ready to go for this September. Good morning. Is the honeymoon period nearly over? Over, Andy Burnham? What's it looking like?
I think it's looking like that after the summer splurge of Instas and TikToks, the political shackles of reality clamp into place for Andy Burnham right now. And they do it in the two things that you just mentioned there, which we can unpick in the next couple of minutes. Yes, the realities of parliamentary scrutiny, about 100 questions-ish coming his way and 3.5 hours of questioning in Parliament yesterday. There's Prime Minister's questions around the corner at lunchtime today. And then the backdrop, what he faces in the autumn, in particular the budget. And as you were saying there, we're hearing from Faisal in the news, that cost of government borrowing, yes, it's something that plenty of governments around the world are facing, but it is a brutal reality that has a financial impact in terms of the numbers being crunched ahead of that budget, and bluntly is a restricting influence on what the government can do. And so, yeah, you get a moment where, and you'll get lots of these, where some of the rhetoric and the language and the tone that we've seen in the last couple of weeks, which are interesting and worth unpicking, collide with the crunching reality of the trade-offs to come.
And in terms of the questioning today at Prime Minister's Questions, I know a lot of this is the style, and that, you know, a lot of people saying, I want to know about the substance, but there is an important moment for him in this, isn't there? And also, you know, how he manages to land those messages and keep landing those messages in that bear pit.
Yeah, absolutely. Because Prime Minister's Questions is atypical of Parliament and Westminster in the round, but it is the bit that a lot of people will catch at least a glimpse of when they don't catch glimpses of plenty of the rest of it. And, you know, when you dive into the Prime Ministerial memoirs, you see how big a moment in the week for any Prime Minister it is. So Tony Blair described PMQs as the most nerve-wracking, discombobulating, nail-biting, bowel-moving, terror-inspiring, courage-draining experience in my Prime Ministerial life. Sounds like coming on the Today programme, actually, come to think of it. David Cameron talked about it. I dreaded it all week. It's as intimidating, demanding, exhausting and downright terrifying as anything you do as Prime Minister. So it takes up a lot of brain space and mental energy, the preparation in the days building up to it, often beginning on a Monday for some Prime Ministers. And it is key, alongside, of course, social media and plenty of other things, in setting the tone and, therefore, if you like, the image that a Prime Minister projects. And how is Andy Burnham going to go about doing that? As I say, he had something of a long-running dress rehearsal yesterday, but the kind of real thing, if you like, or the weekly ritual begins today.
In terms of the bond prices being at their highest level since 2008, top economists are calculating the Prime Minister might face a shortfall of up to £14 billion in his autumn budget. In terms of what questions are going to be asked, surely it's about that and whether there's going to be tax increases and whether he'll stick with the triple lock commitment. You know, he can't have much wriggle room to not answer these at some point, can he? And to have that direction of travel sealed.
Completely that. So all of the above, we've heard what Lord Jim O'Neill has been saying to Faisal around the questions that he believes and others think it might pose around some of those sort of sacred cows of politics like the triple lock on pensions. The Labour Party have said that they're committed to it in this Parliament. How do they approach the realities of those bond market numbers? The budget countdown process is underway. It has these movements have significant and real impacts on the numbers, and then taking that specific example and broadening it out, how does Andy Burnham translate this big picture outlook that he set out from the stump in the Makerfield constituency of a few months ago through the summer to yesterday into the reality of an inbox that he inherits, which is of course pretty much the same as the one that Keir Starmer wrestled with. Oh, and indeed that by-election, that little parting gift that Keir Starmer decided to leave him just yesterday lunchtime, yes, ahead of that first Commons appearance.
Because Keir Starmer said he's not carrying on as an MP. And do we know anything about that by-election?
Well, it'll be interesting. That's what we know about it. I mean, and you know, politics is always about what happens next rather than what happened before. And yes, Keir Starmer changed his mind and his critics say, you know, there was another U-turn, etc., etc. But what's interesting is that it is a contest where the Green Party will see itself as competitive, where Zach Polanski, the Green Party leader in England and Wales, has expressed a desire to be an MP in London at some point. So can he walk past being there candidate? It's not the kind of by-election. I mean, there's rarely by-elections that prime ministers revere or look forward to, unless it's the one that gets you into Parliament to become prime minister, I suppose. This is one he could have rather done without in what's going to be a busy and lively autumn.
Maybe Binface will be back. Who knows? Chris Mason, our political editor. Thank you.
7:15. Well, one of the issues we've just heard mentioned and which the Prime Minister, one of the decisions he'll have to make is about who to let out of prison and who to keep in to ease a shortage of jail spaces. And of course, the killers of PC Andrew Harper will now be kept in. But the Thames Valley Police Federation are going to Downing Street today to hand in a petition with more than a million signatures calling for that. Anyway, why? Well, Eileen O'Connor is chair of the Thames Valley Police Federation and joins us now. Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. What was your reaction when you heard the Prime Minister's decision over the weekend?
I think my initial reaction was mixed, quite honestly. Mixed in terms of why did we have to have a petition in the first place to make this happen? And actually, the one minute I can't do anything to now I'm changing, we can make the changes necessary to keep Andrew Keller's behind bar. And then on the other hand, for me, I was delighted that actually common sense prevailed and the government were able to make those changes.
Why then are you still delivering the petition today?
Because I think it's important when I started this journey in terms of starting the petition, I started it to see whether I could galvanise the public's opinion and whether it was the same as my view and my members' view. And we got over 1 million signatures. We're up to 1,071,000 people of the great British public who have backed that campaign. And I think it's right for them to cement their strength of feeling and the pressure that we put as a result of that petition that has made the changes that have come to fruition. And I think it's a bit of history for me that, as I say, it's the end of the journey for this particular campaign and it's right to deliver that petition.
And have you been surprised by the scale of the public reaction? It's obviously a story that caught the public mood, but 1 million signatures is remarkable, isn't it?
It's huge. It just shows that the British public are behind policing. What we need to see now is we need to see the government, the current sitting government, get behind policing. We need better funding. We need better support. We need and we need to make sure that we are treated fairly by this government that's sitting and address the issues that police officers face every single day.
What are those issues and what would you say when you deliver that petition today, what would you say to those in Parliament, to those in power, to Andy Burnham, who faces his first PMQs today, about repairing relations between politics and the police?
Yeah, I would say, so what I'd like to the Prime Minister to realise is what it's like to be a police officer in this day and age in 2026. Every 10 minutes in the UK, an officer is assaulted, sometimes seriously assaulted, and sometimes they lose their lives. We just need to look at what happened recently in Cleveland with those two officers who were tragically killed. Andrew Harper paid the ultimate price for serving his community. And there's an exodus still happening across police forces in this country. And they really need to address that. We need to have proper funding. This part of the puzzle, what they've done in terms of the early release scheme, that's just one part of the puzzle for me.
Okay.
Everything needs to be addressed. The root and branch review of the criminal justice system, the court system, sentencing, you name it. Because what we've seen previously is funding for policing in this country we are always the last piece of the pie. We always get the crumbs at the end. And that needs to change. The focus needs to change for me.
Well, we'll continue to cover those subjects in detail on this programme. Eileen O'Connor, Chair of the Thames Valley Police Federation. Thank you.
19 minutes past seven now. UK natural gas futures have jumped by more than 8% this morning, raising concerns about energy costs as we head into the winter. Leanna Byrne is back with some more.
Yeah, no. Yes, Sam, and that takes them to around their highest level since early 2023. And because gas often helps to set the wholesale price of electricity in Britain, a sustained rise in gas prices could eventually put upward pressure on household energy bills too. And Sophie Corbeau is Global Research Scholar at the Centre on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University and former Head of Gas Analysis at BP and joins me now. Good morning.
Morning.
So how much of this rise comes down specifically to disruption around the Strait of Hormuz?
Quite a lot, actually. You have to realise that there is almost no LNG which is going through the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, before the war, we used to have about 3 LNG cargoes going through every day. Now it's more like 1 every 3 to 4 days. So that has really impacted the global LNG flows. When I'm looking at, global LNG imports, they have actually decreased by more than 3% year on year. We have been saved by the fact that additional LNG is coming from countries such as Canada, the United States, but still global LNG imports have declined.
If Europe and Asia both get a cold winter, are they effectively competing for the same limited supply of LNG though?
That's exactly the problem. And indeed, because we have absolutely no certainty when LNG flows from Qatar and the Emirates are going to come back, we are going to be competing with Asia. And actually, the competition has already been going on. I mean, Asia has actually managed to divert some LNG cargoes away from Europe, which is why we have very low storage levels in preparation for winter in continental Europe in particular.
So how vulnerable are you talking about then?
If we have a normal winter, I think we should be okay. But there is going to be constant pressure on prices. However, my concern is if we have a series of negative factors. So, for example, not enough wind, a very cold winter, and maybe, you know, some outage, which can be a liquefaction plant or a pipeline, which is impacting the European gas market. Then things could get a little bit tighter, which, of course, is going to be reflected in terms of prices. We're not talking about basically shortages right now.
So we're not comparing this energy. So we're not comparing this with the energy crisis in 2022. I know we're not back at those levels, but the direction of travel, it does seem worrying.
It's indeed, the prices have been increasing quite substantially over the past couple of months, precisely because European gas storage is really, really low. I mean, much lower, about 15 percentage points lower than where it should be right now. And storage is very important, as you can imagine, in order to meet households' residential gas demand during winter. And this is why you can see prices increasing.
All right. Anne-Sophie Corbeau, Global Research Scholar at the Centre on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. Thank you so much for joining us. And just before I go, news just in. BP on Wednesday appointed Ian Tyler as chairman of the board and said Amanda Blank will step down as independent director once a successor has been appointed.
Leanna, thanks very much for that. There you go, the sound of some Humboldt penguins, all in a bid to tell you about a new therapeutic suit that has been designed for the penguins using copper and zinc to speed up their recovery from surgery for wounds often sustained when they're trapped in fishing nets. Now, while these new coats are innovative, the need for them in the first place, of course, reflects the impact of human activity on penguins' lives and health. Nicole Hex here, a wildlife vet from Chile with experience in wildlife rescue and rehabilitation, currently working as a vet nurse in Australia. Nicole, welcome to the programme.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's fascinating to hear about this innovation. Tell us more about these copper and zinc suits.
Well, this project brings together Conservation Humboldt, or Conservation Humboldt, that is a non-profit organization that was established in La Serena, Chile, in 2015. They do rescue and rehab of marine wildlife, and especially Humboldt penguins. And they team up with Kimbavet, which develops textile solutions for veterinary use. So this collaboration began because Dr. Thomas Pino-Demke contacted Kimbavet with the idea of adapting their products, body cobre or body copper, for penguins. So they're adapting and testing a copper zinc garment to protect wounds and support the rehab for these rescue penguins.
So the penguins, the penguins will be put in this garment, in this coat, so that they don't get further infection and they can heal properly? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So initially it was used for dogs and cats after the desex, so they don't lick their wounds. But now it's adapted for penguins for their anatomy and their behavior during the rehab.
And in terms of how it works, does it just protect them from themselves, from pecking, so they don't hurt themselves
further? From pecking, damage their wounds, or taking out the stitches.
Okay. And how long do they wear them for? Do we know?
Usually with the lesions or wounds on penguins, they take about several weeks to a few months to heal. And the idea of this is that can help with the healing time and make it less time. So they will have to use it for the whole process of the wound healing.
And this is also, I mean, as I mentioned, because they're getting injured because of human activity.
Yes. Human activity, sometimes predators like seals or sea lions, and boat injuries.
And I suppose, I mean, although we wish that wasn't the case, we are having to, this innovation is necessary because we are also concerned and should be concerned about the extinction or the harm to the species, and certain species are faring worse than others. Is that right?
Yeah, it's right. Also, they have seen that the Humboldt penguin population has declined in northern Chile and Peru.
So this is why for certain groups it's really necessary.
Yeah, it's really necessary, and it could also be adapted for other species of penguins that are also endangered.
Well, good luck to the teams and those putting these coats on the penguins and in terms of preservation and the innovation. It's an optimistic, yeah, it's optimistic, I suppose, in one way, but it's sad in the first place that they're having to be operated on and looked after. Nicole Heck, a wildlife vet there from Chile, telling us about that latest innovation. Thank you.
26 minutes past seven, time to say good morning again to Jonathan with the sport.
Good morning. Yes, the Premier League clubs excelled themselves last night ahead of the summer transfer deadline at 11 o'clock. By the time the transfer window shut, between them, their overall spending had reached £3.46 billion. You heard me correctly. The biggest deal involved the Argentina midfielder Enzo Fernandez. He moved from Chelsea to Manchester City for a joint British transfer record fee of £125 million. We'll have much more sport on that, and almost with business news, I think, in the next hour. Meanwhile, in the last half hour in New York, the top seed in the men's singles at the US Open, Alexander Zverev, has just survived a five-set marathon to scramble his way into round two, but Britain's Arthur Ferry won't be joining him. He went out in straight sets to the 13th seed, Lorenzo Musetti. Plenty for our correspondent, Russell Fuller, to tell us about, starting with that near miss for Zverev.
He did very nearly go the way of Novak Djokovic, Jonathan. Lorenzo Sonego would have been the first man to beat the men's top seed in the first round of a Grand Slam since Ivo Karlovic beat Leighton Hewitt at 2003's Wimbledon. He lost all six previous matches to Zverev. He was 2 points from victory in the fourth set, but thanks to one break of serve midway through the fifth, Zverev won the decider 6-4 to bring an end to a four-hour, 52-minute match, which finished at 5 minutes to two in the morning, which is actually 6 minutes earlier than the Venus Williams match finished a couple of nights ago.
By then, Arthur Ferry tucked up in bed. Not the dream debut for him in New York, was it?
And thinking about a flight home, having lost 6-3, 6-3, 7-5 to the 13th seed, Lorenzo Musetti. But he didn't serve well. He made 43 unforced errors and didn't really seem to come to terms with the speed of the court. Now, he said afterwards that he had no regrets about playing in a tour event in Winston-Salem last week. And it worked out very well because he reached the final, the first ATP tour final of his career. But it certainly made life harder for him in New York. He had only Sunday and Monday to practice. And he hadn't played here since a couple of matches in the boys' singles back in 2019. This is how Ferry saw it.
Tough match, tough player. I had a big task at hand. But yeah, I was getting better and better as the match went on. I slowly started to get used to the conditions and play better tennis, but managed to play a really bad game at 5-all in the third set, and the match was over when I was kind of feeling like I could get into the match. Yeah.
And you may remember Arthur Ferry wearing earplugs at Wimbledon at times during the change of ends. Well, he did the same in New York, where it's a lot noisier, I have to say. He says it helps him calm down, think clearly, and not have any distractions.
Which is exactly what Fran Jones is going to need, because she's got to come back after a rain delay, meaning she only played one set.
Yes, she did get on court, though. Jan Chojnski's match was delayed until Wednesday entirely because of the weather. Fran Jones did at least win that set, 6-4 against Magda Linette, but they came on court at 9 o'clock in the evening. And Jonathan, this really is the less glamorous side of Grand Slam tennis. Most of the crowd had gone. It was court five. The drizzle began towards the end of the set. Play was suspended after Fran Jones made it very clear she didn't think it was safe and would much rather come back tomorrow.
Russell Fuller, who will be back later today at 5:30 this afternoon on BBC Sounds for that match. Katie Bolter, Jacob Fernley and Toby Samuel also due to play. I should say that the 2023 champion Coco Gauff and the world number two, Elena Rybakina, all through to round two. And we were talking to the England women's cricket captain, Charlie Dean, this time yesterday. Well, she led the team to victory in that first one-day international against Ireland, 6 wickets after a record chase of 282 in Leicester.
Jonathan, thanks very much. We've just been joined by Michael Burke in the studio, which must mean we will hear about Moral Maze for this evening. Michael, hello.
Morning, Emma. We seem to be in the middle of a mental health epidemic. 9 million of us are now on drugs for depression in England alone. Last year, more than 1 million children were referred to mental health services, a figure that's doubled in less than 7 years. It's a moral as well as medical issue. Is everyday stress and unhappiness being needlessly and harmfully pathologised? Is it a consequence of poverty, inequality, poor jobs, housing? Or something deeper, a loss of meaning and purpose, a sign of a society coming apart? What's wrong with us? Mental health and the moral maze after the news at 8 tonight.
Michael, thank you very much indeed. It's now 29 minutes to 8. Coming up before 8 o'clock, a war of words between Russia and Germany. What does it mean for our security in the UK? Russia editor Steve Rosenberg joins us just after the news.
But you're listening to Today on Radio 4, in case you needed reminding, with Amal Rajan over there, Emma Barnett over here. It's 29 minutes to 8, and now a summary of the news with Alan Smith.
Iran says it launched drones and missiles at US bases across the Middle East in response to fresh American attacks. The Iranian Red Crescent reported that shrapnel from one US airstrike hit a home that was hosting a wedding, killing five people and wounding dozens more. US Central Command insists civilians were not targeted. The military in Jordan said it had intercepted 13 ballistic missiles from Iran, while Kuwait also said it was responding to attacks. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has given an upbeat assessment of his country's war in Ukraine, saying he expects Ukrainian forces to keep crumbling. But Mr. Putin acknowledged that Ukrainian drone attacks inside Russia had caused damage. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned commercial airlines that Russian airspace is now completely unsafe because of Ukrainian drone attacks. President Putin has accused Germany of fabricating evidence to blame Moscow for an attempted drone attack at Leipzig airport last month. Germany has announced the closure of Russia's consulate in Bonn. Russian officials have dismissed the allegations as baseless and absurd. A former minister with close ties to Andy Burnham says rising government borrowing costs will force Labour to confront the cost of pensions and welfare. Lord O'Neill, who was Mr. Burnham's economics adviser when he entered Downing Street, has repeated his call for an end to the triple lock on the state pension. The United Nations says its response to last week's flash floods in Nepal is now focused on relief and recovery rather than rescue. Nearly 4,000 people are still missing and over 1,100 bodies have been found. Search teams are still looking for survivors trapped in tunnels in hydroelectric power stations. And hundreds of families say they've waited months or even years for a dementia diagnosis for a loved one, with delays affecting their work, finances and mental health. The Alzheimer's Society is calling for a national standard so that anyone referred by their GP receives an accurate diagnosis within 18 weeks.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It is 27 minutes to 8. So Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday accused Germany of planting evidence to blame Moscow for an attempted drone attack at Leipzig airport.
I believe this is primarily linked to the domestic political situation in Germany. The Chancellor's domestic political position is precarious. He does not enjoy the trust of his citizens, and it is clear why. Where is the evidence? Well, they have planted the evidence.
Well, to be quite clear, Mr. Putin didn't offer any evidence for his assertion that Germany was behind this plant. As you heard, he simply said that Friedrich Merz had done this because he was trying to shore up public support, particularly because he's worried about the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland. Well, the German Interior Minister, Alexander Dobrindt, said that the evidence was clear that, in fact, agents acting on behalf of Moscow had targeted a Ukrainian plane. As Frank Gardner was explaining to us, Leipzig Airport is a very important sort of cargo transition airport. Michael Gala is a member of Merz's CDU party and a foreign policy coordinator for the European People's Party group in the European Parliament. When I spoke to him a short time ago, I asked him how significant an escalation in tensions between Germany and Russia this is.
Well, it is a new stage of interference, of hybrid warfare. We've never had an armored drone before. And we have had other incidents, drone overflights, but not, so to say, obviously with the objective to destroy these Ukrainian freight aircraft. So it is a significant development. And it was important to have the waterproof evidence that it was Russia. So it took some weeks until the government pronounced itself officially. And I think the reaction is proportionate and prudent.
What is Germany's assessment of what actually happened?
Well, the assessment is that this drone has been
planted there and taken there. They gave no details for security reasons, either by a professional actor there from their side, or what they call the one-way spies. So they hire private people for a certain task and to plant, in this case, these drones there. It doesn't matter in which way it was done. It was of Russian origin. That is the decisive thing. And it shows that Russia is, on a daily basis, we are not in war, as the interior minister said, but we are exposed on a daily basis to hybrid warfare.
May I politely put to you the position of President Putin? To be clear, Mr. Putin has offered no evidence for this assertion, including in his long press conference last night. But he says Germany planted evidence there in order to blame Russia, and that Friedrich Merz's government did that to distract from their domestic political problems. I know you're laughing. To distract from their domestic political problems because he's worried about the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland. Can I ask you to address directly Mr. Putin's claim?
Well, when he opens his mouth, he lies. And he is a trained KGB man and knows how to react. I mean, it is crystal clear that it was of Russian origin, and he knows it. And he knows that we know it, that he knows it. So I don't care what he says. And we will probably also see some reaction, closing General Consulate in St. Petersburg or the Goethe Institute. But we have to take the measures necessary, and we have to say who it was. Otherwise, he thinks he can continue unhindered.
Do you believe that the German response, including that of the Interior Minister, Mr. Dobrindt, Alexander Dobrindt, has gone far enough?
We have to work out a bit more on some issues. For instance, on the visa issuing, I'm clearly of the opinion we should not issue visas to Russian tourists. We should reduce visa issuing for family purposes and medical emergencies, and not for businessmen who would try to circumvent the sanctions, perhaps, when they have partners in Germany.
What do you think is Vladimir Putin's real agenda here?
His real agenda is to destabilize our societies all over Europe, not only in Germany, but Germany is one focal point, of course. Everything that harms us is in his favor, as he sees it. Whether it is direct war or it is hybrid warfare, whether it's disinformation, all measures are in place and applied, and that is his objective, weakening us in our support for Ukraine. But our resolve remains as it is.
Well, that was Michael Gahler from the CDU, Merz's party. Let's turn to Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor. Steve, just take us through what Mr. Putin was up to, what he's been up to this week, but also in that press conference last night.
Yeah, well, first of all, Russia's reaction is, as you might expect, denial and prolific finger-pointing the other way. In other words, Russia accusing the accuser. That's why you get President Putin exclaiming, "Where's the evidence that this was Russia? They planted the evidence." And we've seen this kind of reaction many times before. Whenever Russia is accused of something by Western governments, you know, whether of shooting down the Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine in 2014, or the Salisbury poisonings, the reaction normally is, "You, the West, are out to frame us. Where is your proof? Russia is completely innocent." So, yes, a war of words, more than just words, judging by the conclusion reached by the German authorities, and we heard their talk of a new stage of hybrid warfare.
Well, just before we turn to what this means for Britain, Steve, I just want to play our listeners a clip, because Mr. Putin was asked by a journalist, wasn't he, whether military industrial facilities here in the UK could actually become military targets. This is what he said.
Can British military industrial facilities located on the territory of Britain become military targets?
That is classified, a military secret.
Steve, what's he up to there?
Well, if you want a 100% accurate answer to that question, then the man you need to call is Vladimir Putin, because, yeah, sadly, I don't have his number for you. My impression is that the aim of that, that short sentence, was psychological pressure, you know, to keep Britain guessing, to get Britain stressing out about Russia's intentions. And maybe to encourage Britain to think twice about being such a staunch supporter of Ukraine. It's a bit like the Russian newspaper article I read a few days ago that suggested that Andy Burnham should be seeing Russia not in his dreams, but in his nightmares. It doesn't mean, I don't think, that Russian missiles are about to come raining down on UK defence facilities. But having said that, you know, yesterday we did hear Germany's interior minister speaking about the well-established pattern of Russian hybrid operations in Europe. So there may well be concern in the UK that Russia could step up hybrid activities in Britain, cyber attacks or sabotage or other covert operations. But I would say this, Amal, that over the last 4.5 years, we have heard from Moscow to the West many warnings, many threats, and we've witnessed a lot of saber-rattling here on the very day of the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin warned foreign nations that any attempt to interfere with his invasion would lead to consequences the like of which you have never seen in your history. That was 4.5 years ago, and I say that not to be complacent, but just for context.
Steve, always a pleasure to talk to you. Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, thank you.
It's 18 minutes to 8, a week on from Nepal's deadly flash flood. At least 1,000 people have been killed and thousands are missing. Rescuers are still attempting to find and save more survivors wherever they can, including the hundreds trapped in tunnels in the worst affected areas. And this amongst those rescuers is the filmmaker and photographer and mountaineer Manish Maharajan, who is working with the army and other rescuers using drones to try to find people and has sometimes been using speakers mounted on those drones to call out or play music for those stranded on hillsides or trapped in tunnels.
With the drone, what we did was like we looked if it was safe for the rescuers to go inside first, because like looking at the condition of the tunnel, there's like very less chance that you find survivors. So our first priority was like looking for the safety of the rescuers that were going inside.
And I mean, in terms of how big this rescue effort is and how difficult this is, what can you say?
If you look at the terrain, it's very hard for the helicopters to land. So even to fly the drones, we have to get like airlifted. So a lot of places, it's very difficult to land the helicopters and stuff. So it's difficult. We don't have electricity. We don't have communication. We just like started having a continuous electricity since yesterday here in Dhunji. Everything is difficult here right now. Everything is risky. We have risks of like the river rising. Every time we enter into a tunnel, we are just like few meters above the water level of the river. It's very risky right now for everyone, all the rescuers that are working here, for us, everyone.
It's extraordinary. Manish there, and authorities in Nepal have also, as part of efforts, began burying unidentified bodies after taking samples of their DNA. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri travelled to Bechawati in the district of Rasua as some survivors returned to what is left of their town.
I'm in the village of Bechawati, and people who lived here tell me it looks nothing like before. There are barely any buildings standing. It's by the riverbed, so it would have been extremely vulnerable to the flood. And there's this smell. It's pungent and it smells rotten. And if I keep walking on the ground, which has hardened mud and a lot of debris from the houses that have been ripped apart, there's also a school bus and it's been upturned. I can see a child's backpack inside. Imagine this being your home and coming back if you were able to survive the flood and seeing it look like this. Some of the villagers have come back to recover whatever they can find. I can also spot one older man who's crouching on the floor and smoking a pipe.
So your home was over there, oh, down there by the bus. Yeah. And it's that area there?
When I finally managed to get here, both my house and wife were gone. People told me she was still inside. No one has come here to help me yet, so I'm waiting here. The rescue teams pulled out a body from just up the road. I asked them to help, and they said they would come here, but they haven't shown up.
closer to the river. If I look down, I can see there are logs of wood that have been stacked up. And there's a group of people who are watching it burn. Someone just told me that that's the body of their neighbor, Ashish Banya. He was disabled and wasn't able to escape the floods. It's his body that they're burning right now.
His mother had gone to the market to buy vegetables. When the flood came, she ran up the hill from here. Everyone tried escaping the flood waters, but Ashish can't move without someone's help. He was trapped.
We've reached a displacement camp near the town of Bitrabati. There are some tents and concrete buildings, no beds. But the children here seem happy. They may not be fully aware of what's happened to their families. The death toll keeps growing here. And there are thousands missing. But Nepal will also have to reckon with all the people who have now lost their homes.
Hello.
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 People are living in makeshift rooms in this camp. It's concrete floors with just grey mats on the floor, 10 people sharing a room. Isengale tells me he'd already lost his home in the 2015 earthquake that had killed thousands. And now he says that he's lost 7 of his relatives, including his wife and his brother.
Oh, where I go? What I do? I don't know. I have lost my wife, my brother, my 2 sister, or my cousins, everything.
It's started to rain now, which means it will be another challenging day of rescues for emergency teams. Every time our team goes out, we're not sure what we'll learn. This time, it's become very clear that people are struggling to understand the scale of what they've lost. And even a week after the flood, Nepal is still uncovering the full extent of the disaster.
Azadeh Mashiri there reporting.
In a few minutes' time, the family's living in limbo waiting for a dementia diagnosis. How can we speed up that process? But first, it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Chinnay McDonald, director of Theos, the religion and society think tank.
Good morning. Dolly Parton's estate has announced that Dolly Fest, a festival honouring the singer's life and legacy, is set to take place in both London and Nashville next year, in place of a traditional public memorial. But why a festival? Last weekend, many gathered from across the country for festivals, lugging their camping equipment and stoves and wellies and raincoats to make temporary homes alongside others for a few days. My family and I were at Greenbelt, a faith, arts and justice festival I've been part of for years and am now a trustee of. And I've been reflecting on how much I crave this annual meeting place. Despite the mud and the unpredictable weather and the inconvenience of being without our usual creature comforts, it always feels like coming home. There's something sacred about festivals. The Greek word ecclesia is used in the New Testament to describe a gathering of people. We've come to think of ecclesia as simply denoting something to do with church, but in the first century, ecclesia was really simply a gathering of people, just as festivals gather people together in an in-between space. All of life, all of human frailty and resilience and beauty can be found in the gathering together that takes place at festivals. During my Greenbelt weekend, I laughed and cried and enjoyed great food and danced and was challenged. For me, festivals represent the very human craving to want to gather with others, to celebrate, to remember, to dream, and sometimes to mourn. At another Christian event, Big Church Festival, which took place at the same time, thousands were gathered together when tragedy struck, after a sign fell, killing church leader Robert Gwanko. Friends there, some of whom witnessed the horror, are asking questions of God. How could such a thing happen at a place that was supposed to be full of joy? There are no answers, no ways to make it better. But in our increasingly disembodied and individualistic, atomized lives, Gathering reminds us that we belong to one another, embodied in our joy and in our grief. I'll never forget raising a glass with hundreds of others at Greenbelt's rousing beer and hymns, where we remembered those we had lost and sang the soul-stirring words of Thine be the glory. Let the church with gladness hymns of triumph sing, for her Lord now liveth, death has lost its sting. St. Paul encourages the early Christian community to bear one another's burdens. And maybe this is why we gather. Not because gathering can protect us from sorrow, but because neither sorrow nor hope were ever meant to be carried alone.
That was Thought for the Day with Chinne McDonald, Director of Theos, the Religion and Society Think Tank. It brings us to 9 minutes to 8.
Hundreds of families say they've had to wait months or even years for a dementia diagnosis for a loved one, and that delay has affected their work, finances and mental health. How could it not? Dementia is the only major condition that the NHS does not have a target for the time it takes to get a diagnosis, something the Alzheimer's Society says should be changed. Well, I'm joined now by Keith Andrews, who's got very personal experience of this from Bournemouth, whose wife Susan lives with mixed dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And in a moment, I'll talk to Dr. Tom Russ, reader in old age psychiatry at the University of Edinburgh and consultant psychiatrist in NHS Lothian. But Keith, let me come to you first. Good morning.
Good morning.
How long did it take for you two and you and Susan to get a diagnosis?
Well, it was a little bit strange. We got the tests done very, very quickly, but the memory test clinic, a memory assessment clinic, said that it was going to take something like nearly a year to get the final diagnosis. So we were lucky enough to be able to go privately. After about 6 months, I'd had enough. So we paid privately to see a private specialist to get the diagnosis.
And when you say you'd had enough, what do you mean by that? Because what sort of symptoms was Susan displaying? How were your lives changed?
Sue couldn't concentrate or do any of her usual hobbies and activities that she liked doing. She loved to make cake decorating and flower arranging. She couldn't concentrate to do that anymore. She had to give all that up. And day-to-day life was getting harder and harder. I mean, with Alzheimer's, as we know, it eats away at your brain and kills the brain cells off. And so gradually different things that she loved doing, like reading and things like, she just couldn't, she could still read, but it's like Groundhog Day. She picked up a book, couldn't remember what had happened before, so she'd have to go back to the beginning of the book, and life gets awful.
I mean, it sounds awful, and I was also just going to say, you know, sleep can be very affected as well.
It can, yes. I mean, it's for that person and for the carers as well, because you have to be on alert all day long, 24 hours a day, wondering what's going to happen next and what's going on all the time.
So I understand you in the end, so frustrated, you went private to get that diagnosis. However you get there, what then changes when you receive it? Because that's what's at the heart of this discussion today.
That's right. Well, when you get the diagnosis, you know for certain that it is Alzheimer's. I mean, that's not pleasant. It's scary and it's horrible. But you know. So you know then what to look out for, what where you're going. And for the carers, we know what to, because you can access all sorts of tutorial courses and things from the Alzheimer's Society that help you understand what's going on. Before that, you things are happening and you don't know why they're happening. And so you don't know what to do, how to cope with them. But once you got that final diagnosis, you're able to understand a lot better what's happening, so you can help yourself and the person who's got it.
Keith, stay with us just there. Let me go to Dr. Tom Russ. What is going on with this waiting time? And I know it's not exactly the same all over the UK, but you've heard there some of the impact.
Yeah, can I just start by saying how moved I was to hear that story. And while it's unique, it's sadly all too familiar. And I start every appointment at our memory clinic with an apology that people have had to wait 9 months in Edinburgh. I think there are a number of factors at work here. One is that the numbers of people affected by dementia is increasing because the population is aging. There are more older people than before.
Yeah,
we don't have enough staff in some services, that's doctors, nurses, occupational therapists. I think many services are still recovering from COVID. Actually, that was a huge, huge knock to services. But the bottom line is, in memory clinics, we're really doing what we did when they were set up in the 1990s, and we're not innovating. We're not trying new models of care, which I think is essential.
Do you think, though, I'm very struck that you start with an apology each time, which you know, if in a very difficult scenario, must be, you know, even stranger as well in some ways for you and for the patients and the patient's family. Do you think we can do better in terms of speeding up diagnosis times, just to start with that?
I think we can. And to me, I think what we need to do is focus on research. We need to start to implement biomarkers, biological markers for dementia, so we can make more robust diagnoses. So things like blood tests, which are being used experimentally, but we're almost at the stage where we could start using them pretty much routinely. Ultimately, we need more research to find new treatments so that when the diagnosis comes, we can actually offer something that's going to make a huge difference. So the treatments we have now are effective and do make a difference to people. But we also need to innovate. So we need to design new models of care which have the person with dementia and their family at the center. And that includes things like developing more posts for advanced nurses who can lead, which is a model that's used in other conditions. And we also need to just use technology in both to inform the assessment, but also to direct treatment.
Dr. Tom Russ, we have to leave it there with you. If I just give the final word to you, Keith, I mean, how's the family now? How's Susan doing? How are you?
She's in a permanent residential care home nowadays. I mean, it's just her body there. It's not my Sue anymore, I'm afraid. But can I just say something on the delay? I mean, can I put it into some sort of perspective? I mean, we had the test done very within 2 or 3 weeks of the GP saying, suspecting that Sue did have some form of dementia. The 2 or 3 tests, the brain scan and the in-depth memory tests, were done within 2 to 3 weeks. So all the results were sat there waiting. And then we were told, we've got everything we need to know to tell you, except just perhaps the final 30-minute consultation with the consultant. But we're not going to tell you for a year what those results are. And that was devastating, absolutely devastating that was.
Keith, thank you for telling us that and also sharing, you know, how things have been and how things are with your wife, Susan, and Dr. Tom Russ. Thank you to you.
2 minutes to 8. Let's go to the weather with Chris Fawkes.
Thanks a lot, Amal. And OK, there's some bright spells initially across eastern areas of England and northern Scotland. But for many of us today, it is going to be a cloudy day and we've got some rain around as well. Now, for England and Wales, many areas are already starting off with a cloud. We've got some damp weather for southwest England, some heavier rain pushing across Wales, parts of the Midlands, into northern areas of England as we go on through the day. The rain turning heavier and more persistent here. It's also a wet start for Northern Ireland with some fairly persistent heavy rain and a few patches of rain breaking out across southern Scotland. But as we go through the day, the main weather front, the warm front, will extend its way northwards into Scotland. So the rain's going to turn heavier for southern Scotland and probably at times the rain reaching the central lowlands as well. Probably staying dry and bright throughout, though, across northern Scotland, and probably little, if any, rain reaching the southeast of England. It'll probably still be a few damp patches of drizzle working in across parts of Wales and southwest England this afternoon. So cloudy, rain at times probably best sums up the weather for many areas. Temperatures 17 to 20 for Scotland and Northern Ireland, England and Wales, seeing highs of between 20 and 23 Celsius this afternoon. That's the latest.
Chris, thanks very much. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 2nd of September. The headlines this morning. Iran has fired drones and missiles at US bases across the Middle East after another wave of American attacks reportedly killed 5 Iranian civilians. Andy Burnham is being urged to respond to high government borrowing costs by ending the pensions triple lock. We'll find out what this means for his premiership and for our lives too at 8:10. And families and carers of dementia sufferers say their loved ones are having to wait months or even years for a diagnosis.
Indeed, as we were just hearing there from Ken. Coming up in the next hour.
I found it quite difficult to get hold of details of everyday life in the 11th century. So I went to Bayeux to look at the tapestry, and of course, it was a treasure chest for me.
and for many others to come as it opens at the British Museum. The author Ken Follett there reflecting on the power of the Bayeux Tapestry. And speaking of momentous national moments, Amal Rajan, it's your last day here on the Today programme. Are you all right?
I wish someone had told me.
I may have noticed an extra spring in your step as you're going to be counting the hours of sleep you'll be getting after this. But we will be looking back at some of Amal's most memorable moments and, of course, bidding him a fond farewell. But first, the news is read by Alan Smith.
Tehran has launched a fresh wave of drones and missiles at US bases in Jordan, Iraq and Kuwait in response to American airstrikes in southern Iran. The Iranian Red Crescent says one US attack last night hit a home that was hosting a wedding, killing five people and wounding dozens more. US Central Command denied targeting civilians. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
US Central Command said the latest attacks were in response to Tehran trying to hit commercial ships and American forces in the region. It said its targets included air defense sites, radar systems and maritime assets. But Iranian state media reported that civilian sites on Iran's southern coast had also been bombed, with a child among those killed at a wedding ceremony in Sirik County, which lies on the Strait of Hormuz. The US military said it was aware of the reports, but that it never targeted civilians. Iran struck back at US military bases in several countries with reports of missile and drone interceptions. Tehran again warned that it would stop oil from being exported from the Gulf, despite a threat from President Trump to hit at a much harder and higher level, and Washington preparing to impose new economic sanctions.
President Zelensky has warned international airlines and insurers about using Russian airspace amid an escalation in Ukrainian drone attacks. In his nightly address, he said the skies over Russia were becoming unsafe for civilian aviation. President Putin has responded by accusing Ukraine of resorting to state terrorism. From Kyiv, our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports.
Many airlines no longer fly to or over Russia, but some still do. And President Zelensky's warning was aimed directly at them. He said Ukraine was not threatening civilian aviation, but he said his country had a right to strike Russian military and economic targets in self-defense. And international airlines and their insurers must now consider Russian airspace to be completely unsafe and effectively closed. Drone-infested skies, he said, were no place for civilian aviation. At a summit in Kyrgyzstan, President Putin accused Ukraine of state terrorism. But he admitted drone attacks had inflicted damage on Russia and 10% of its oil refineries had yet to be repaired.
A former minister with close ties to Andy Burnham has said that recent rises in the cost of government borrowing will force Labour to deal with pensions and welfare. Lord O'Neill, who was Mr. Burnham's economics adviser as he entered Downing Street, reiterated his calls for an end to the triple lock, which guarantees the state pension rises each year in line with either inflation, wage growth or 2.5%, whichever is the highest. Our economics editor Faisal Islam reports.
Market rates for long-term government borrowing have risen around the world in recent days. For the UK yesterday, they were at their highest level since 1998. Lord O'Neill said the turmoil, while driven mostly by US factors, was proving pretty troublesome for the Prime Minister and would affect his agenda.
It's going to force his own political party and hopefully the whole Whitehall system to get real about dealing with some of the things that are out there that no political figures ever seem to want to deal with, such as the triple lock, excessive spending on welfare.
The government has reaffirmed its manifesto commitment to protect the annual uprating to pensions. Jim O'Neill has long opposed the policy and said the government should include proposals to reduce excessive spending as part of the PM's 10-year plan expected after the budget. The rise in market interest rates threatens to wipe out about half of the government's room for manoeuvre around its borrowing target, meaning there might need to be £12 to £13 billion in tax rises or spending cuts at the budget.
Dozens of Labour MPs have backed proposed changes to the government's plans to tighten the rules on political donations. The Representation of the People Bill is due to be debated by MPs later today. An amendment to ban overseas donations has significant support, as well as another proposal for a cap on UK-based contributions, excluding trade unions. Hundreds of families say they've had to wait months or even years for a dementia diagnosis for a loved one, and that the delay has affected their work, finances and mental health. The Alzheimer's Society is calling for a national standard so that anyone referred by their GP for a dementia assessment receives an accurate diagnosis within 18 weeks. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes reports.
A survey of more than 1,000 families and carers carried out for the Alzheimer's Society revealed that nearly half the people living with dementia waited more than 6 months for an accurate diagnosis after first visiting a GP. The carers say the delay affects their work, makes it harder to plan for the future, and increases the financial pressures for families. The charity wants patients to be diagnosed within 18 weeks of a GP referral, given a care plan and appropriate treatment, putting dementia on a similar footing to other major health conditions such as cancer.
There's been a sharp rise in the number of children going to A&E in England with mental health problems. Figures obtained by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health show a 36% increase over 7 years, with the biggest rise among children aged 6 to 9. Our health correspondent Sophie Hutchinson reports.
In 2019, A&E staff in England saw 55,000 children with a mental health problem. Last year, an extra 20,000 came forward, and there was a 62% rise in 6 to 9-year-olds needing help. The figures show growing numbers of children waiting more than 12 hours to be seen. The Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health urged the government to improve mental health services. The Department of Health says it's planning how to help young people earlier so fewer need emergency care.
The United Nations says its response to last week's flash floods in Nepal is now focused on relief and recovery rather than rescue. Nearly 4,000 people are missing and over 1,100 bodies have been found. Search teams are still looking for survivors trapped in tunnels in hydroelectric power stations. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri reports from the Rasuwa district in northern Nepal.
A week since the flood, and helicopters are still racing to deliver relief to communities cut off by the floods. Some roads have recently been cleared to some of the worst affected areas. But villages like the ones here in Rasuwa are still struggling for fuel and electricity. Rescue operations continue in challenging conditions, and experts from China and India are building temporary bridges to reach remote areas. Foreign rescue teams are also assisting with tunnel rescue operations in hydropower projects, with hundreds still trapped inside. Drones are being deployed over hard-to-reach areas to scan for survivors.
Trading standards officers in Scotland are calling for extra powers to tackle what they describe as an explosion of illegal tobacco sales in some high street shops. The illicit trade has been linked to organised crime. Katie Hunter reports.
The illegal tobacco products include counterfeit cigarettes and those smuggled into the country to avoid tax. They're being sold illegally in some high street shops across the UK. BBC News joined trading standards officers in Inverness as they raided one business where they've found or being sold illicit tobacco products 9 times in 2 years. In England, councils can apply for closure orders to shut down these shops for up to 6 months, but those powers aren't available to local authorities in Scotland. The Scottish Government says it's a serious issue and it's working with partners on how best to deal with it.
Research has shown that a urine test taken at home is able to detect more than 9 out of 10 cases of bladder cancer. The study involved nearly 1,000 patients at 7 hospitals in England and Scotland. It's hoped the success could eventually reduce the number of patients needing invasive procedures. And a flurry of activity on the final day of the English transfer window helped Premier League football clubs break their all-time summer transfer record for a second year in a row. Enzo Fernandez joined Manchester City for a joint British record, £125 million, while Jack Grealish secured a return to Everton. With the details, here's our sports correspondent Joe Linsky.
It is once again a Premier League record window. Between the 20 clubs, more than £3 billion has been spent on transfers. That's a higher figure than ever before, and more than the total spend this summer in Spain, Italy, Germany and France combined. On transfer deadline day, Enzo Fernandez became the 5th player this window to move for more than £100 million. His transfer to Manchester City from Chelsea is a joint British record. Ilerman and Jai will join him at the Etihad. He's moved from Everton, while Jack Grealish has returned to the Toffees on loan. It is City and Chelsea who finished the window as the highest spenders.
That was Joe Linsky.
Alan, thank you so much. The time is now 8:10. Are we on the brink of another financial crisis triggered by the global addiction to debt? The bond market is not a grumpy teenager or nightmare neighbour. It's where governments go to borrow. The price at which they borrow hugely affects our public finances. Gilts are bonds issued by our government. Yesterday, the yield on a 30-year gilt rose to 5.89%. That's the highest since 1998, pushing the government's debt repayments higher. Jim O'Neill, the crossbench peer advisor to the government, has told the BBC that that will force the Prime Minister to get real about dealing with the triple lock on the state pension and also get real about excessive welfare spending. Some context here. This is a global phenomenon, but there are several reasons why Britain may be uniquely exposed. First, cash flow. The rate at which our debt has grown is much faster than other G7 countries. Second, who owns our debt has changed. A generation ago, it was long-term, often British institutional investors like pension schemes. Now it's more likely to be foreign hedge funds looking for a quick hit. Third, and critical, about 30% of UK debt is index-linked. That means it's tied to the retail price index rather than CPI, the consumer price index. That compares to around 10% for most G7 countries. And these so-called linkers mean that the UK is very unusually exposed to inflation shocks. What does all this mean for our economy, for your finances, and for the first Andy Burnham budget, or John Healey budget, due on October the 28th? Well, Ruth Curtis is Chief Executive of the Resolution Foundation and was previously Director of Fiscal Policy at the Treasury. And Sir Howard Davies is Chairman of the Phoenix Group, former Chairman of NatWest until 2024, and also a former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England and former Director of the London School of Economics. Good morning to you both. Ruth, if we could start with the here and now. You've been a key figure in the Treasury in the weeks before a budget. How will the rise in gilt yields be affecting our finances and budget planning right now?
Yeah, thanks and good morning. I think there are really three effects on what the Treasury will be thinking. The first is just the direct costs that you've talked about. So as you say, this means that more of the government spending has to go on these debt interest costs. That means less available to other things. Given the moves we've seen since March, the last time we had an official forecast, it looks like those could be 11 or 12 billion higher. So there will be a lot of moving parts in the forecast. But whatever your plans were, you're now spending a lot more on debt interest than you had hoped. I think there are two other perhaps less obvious effects. One is just the uncertainty in the run-up to the budget. So this is an element of the forecast for the public finances that can move very quickly by very large amounts. That's because we have high debt and all the other things you explained about why we're so sensitive to these moves. And that makes it harder to plan a policy package because it will and could shift quite quickly in the coming weeks. I think the third is it just ups the stakes. It ups the risks and the costs of higher borrowing. And that means not just that you've got to face those higher costs, but the trade-offs between the politics of making difficult decisions and addressing some of those long-run issues in the UK public finances are different. It becomes more risky to spend more than you were planning.
So Howard, we'll come back to the UK and the specifics that Ruth gets into there in a moment. Just before we do that, there's a lot of chatter around, Sir Howard, among investors and in financial media, people that you speak to, about a major crisis. Is such chatter justified?
I don't think it's a major crisis of confidence in the UK government, if that's what you mean. I don't believe that. But
no, a broader global crisis.
Yes, moreover, it is the case that overall debt is growing rather rapidly. The Bank of England, well, Andrew Bailey, as chairman of the Financial Stability Board last week, wrote a letter to his colleagues saying that there is a huge expansion in private sector debt, which is part of the problem. In that people are borrowing enormous sums of money to invest in data centres. I mean, that's the most obvious thing, but there's more debt anyway. And that is putting pressure on interest rates. And he believes that there should be some constraint on the amount of that debt that can grow. Whether that's actually a global financial crisis, I'm not quite sure. I think what it is going to be is a fiscal squeeze, not only on the UK, but really it's time the US did something about their ballooning deficit. They don't seem inclined to do at the moment. And Scott Bessent prefers to just lecture the markets, but I think they're going to have to do something.
All right, so Howard, on the UK specifically, Jim O'Neill says that we need to hear a lot more and soon about curbing spending. And there's also this idea that the uncertainty around whether a Burnham government will cut spending is specifically causing some market jitters. Is that assessment correct?
Yes, I think it is. Unfortunately, we do have a circus built around our budgets, which actually does not happen in many other countries, you know, where there is a whole industry of people led by you, of course, Amol, to create expectations and then dash those expectations, etc. And I think we are going to face a very dicky period between now and the budget. And there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Bank of England. I think something Ruth did not mention, but the Bank of England continues to sell long gilts. And that puts additional pressure on interest rates. The Bank of England have a decision to make on September the 17th about whether they carry on with that. So I think we're going to see a very uncertain period for the next 3 or 4 weeks. And it would be helpful if the government could make some signs about their overall approach to the fiscal balance, which I think could calm things down a bit.
If Ruth, once upon a time, it was really big news that the UK debt had crossed £1 trillion. Today, it's crossed £3 trillion. Does that matter?
It absolutely matters that what's happened is we've now got debt about as big as the same size of our economy. That is why, one of the reasons why these moves hit us so large. And I don't quite agree with Howard that it's just about the circus around a budget. Really, the fundamental question is, how is any government going to face up to the medium-term pressures around defence and ageing? How are they going to address that, whether it's through spending cuts or tax rises? We haven't really heard a political answer from any party as to how those things are going to be squared in the end. And that's really why we get this uncertainty about UK fiscal policy.
So defence and demography, Ruth, are the medium-term challenges. Jim O'Neill and others are talking short-term about the, I mean, it's not easy fruit, but low-hanging fruit, if there is such a thing in fiscal terms, being welfare spending and the pensions triple lock. Just explain, would you, Ruth, why those two things so often become the object of focus?
So I think the triple lock in particular becomes a focus because in an ageing population, the idea that you have pensions, the rate that pensions are paid, growing faster than an average worker in the economy. So because it's the variation between earnings and two other numbers, and you get the higher of those each year, that means pensions are destined to outstrip earnings in the long run. That's a particularly unsustainable policy to have when you have an ageing population. Welfare in general has been a big political focus. It's reasonably stable as a share of the economy, but the big area that has been rising, as we know, is the spending on health and disability benefits. Actually, what this government's done most significantly is increase spending on public services, on health and education, and raise tax to pay for that.
Ruth, thank you. Sir Howard, final thought to you. There is a moral dimension to this as well as economics. Sir Howard, you've got grandchildren, if you don't mind me saying. Debts are future obligations, and we're piling those obligations on young people.
Yes, I think that there was a very good book written a few years ago by David Willetts called The Pinch, where he explained just how it was that the baby boomer generation, of which I'm a proud member, has done very, very well, having free university tuition, which now people have to pay for, and a whole range of other benefits, and that the younger generation has suffered. I think that's a very strong argument, and it's a further reinforcement of the case Ruth rightly makes about the triple lock. We can't afford it, and it really has to be changed. And if a government does not grasp that nettle at some point, then I think its credibility is going to be on the rack.
So Howard Davies, Ruth Curtis, thank you both very much indeed.
Well, listening to that, the Cabinet Office Minister Sally Jameson, Labour MP, good morning.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
The triple lock, we can't afford it, it has to be changed. Has Andy Burnham got the nerve to do so, will he?
But we've been clear that we will be sticking to the triple lock, and also been really clear that it's important that we give people breathing space. There's a cost of living crisis going on, and the Prime Minister is absolutely committed to make sure that as far as possible we give people that breathing space. And it's one of the reasons we've set up a number of task forces, one on cost of living, one on regeneration, and one on public control. And these are all about driving together change and reform to make sure that this country country is working for people and not for shareholders who deliver a poor service.
But, you know, Jim O'Neill, who's been advising the Prime Minister, we've just been hearing him mentioned, he says the government does have to get real on this and on welfare costs. Do you agree with that?
I think the government has been real about it, and the Prime Minister and the Chancellor
has been... Just by saying it's committed to it and it'll carry on doing it come what may in the face of these, you know, borrowing costs and all of the issues we've just been hearing financially? Is that realistic?
We've been absolutely clear that we will be sticking to the fiscal rules and making sure that we're controlling public spending. That's absolutely critical. But what's also critical is that we grow our economy and that we back British business. And the Prime Minister was really clear about that yesterday, that this will be a pro-business government, because that is what is going to be so important to drive our economy forward and to give us the growth that we need in every single postcode up and down the country.
I just don't understand. You know, you look at Keir Starmer's record, he tried to curb welfare costs, he failed. What is going to be different?
Well, I think the Prime Minister set out yesterday a really ambitious and optimistic plan for the future. And absolutely, we need to curb welfare costs. And
so that how will are you going to do that?
Well, that's above my grade, the pay grade. That'll be set out later on. But part of it actually is about supporting young people into work, because for too long, there's been a large number of young people that, frankly, haven't been supported properly, have been ignored, and we're going to change that. So we're supporting businesses through grants and other things to employ young people, particularly those that have been out of work for a long time, but making sure that they've got the right support and, importantly, the right skills to do the jobs now and in the future.
But so what is not above your pay grade is to be a Labour MP and to have a sense of how this is going down and whether there's a change in your own ranks to the reality that's changed because of war, because of oil prices, because of what we've just been talking about. Will he be able to bring the welfare bill down with the current crop of Labour MPs?
Yes, absolutely. I think all Labour
MPs... So that's
MPs,
a change of heart by Labour MPs because you've got a new leader?
No, I think Labour MPs have always been committed to bringing the welfare bill down, because it's an absolute travesty that one in eight young people between the ages of 18 to 24 have not been in education, employment or training. No one is happy about that. And we've always been totally clear that we need to address it and support those young people to make sure that they've got the skills to do the jobs in this economy.
That's absolutely what we're committed to doing. But there might be listeners thinking, when you were given the chance to cut benefits, you rebelled.
No, I think what the Labour MPs, and I think more people more widely want to see, is a package of support to get people off benefits and into work. And that is absolutely possible.
But you might have to cut benefits before you get people into work. These are some tough realities.
I think there's a lot of people out there that want to be in work. They want to be in work, and there's a huge number of factors which have stopped them from doing it historically. So I think the most important thing we do in this initial stage is support those people that want to work to make sure that they can access it.
Well, they've got to have jobs to go to as well. And a lot of businesses do not feel this is yet a pro-business government, that they are in a situation where, because of the table of increases and changes around rights at work and what's going to go on with various contracts, it's a difficult time to produce jobs. That's the other side of it. Can I just ask, when do you know when, you might not, you're the Cabinet Office Minister, do you know when Andy Burnham will commit to spending 3% of GDP on defence?
Well, the Prime Minister's been absolutely clear, and the most important target and the NATO target is getting to 3.5% by 2035. And the Chancellor and the Prime Minister will be setting that out in the spring, how we're going to get to that point. We absolutely must reach that target. Next year, we'll be setting out in the spring review how we're going to get to that point, because it's absolutely critical we meet that NATO target to deal with the threats that the country faces. And the Prime Minister and the Chancellor and the whole government are absolutely committed to that.
Does Andy Burnham still believe in rejoining the European Union?
Look, I think that we deal with the reality as it is, which is we have left the European Union. And what's important now is that we get the absolute best deal for this country and for businesses in this country. Quite frankly, we didn't get a very good deal under the last government. And we've got to absolutely make sure that we do everything we can to ensure that British businesses are not restricted in any way and can access what they need to do to grow and thrive. So I don't think it's about revisiting the old debates of the referendum or of Brexit, because that's already happened and it's done. We deal with the world as it is. Okay. And the world as it is that we need to make sure that we're getting the absolute best deal for our country, whether that's with the EU or, frankly, any other country across the world.
We shall see. The Cabinet Office Minister there, thank you for your time, Sally Jameson.
25 past eight, Nick is going to be broadcasting from the British Museum tomorrow because the Bayeux Tapestry Exhibition finally opens. It's the first time in nearly 1,000 years that the tapestry is back on British soil. And we're hearing from friends of the programme about their reflections on the tapestry and the most famous battle in British history. Today, it's the best-selling author Ken Follett, who has various novels set in the medieval period, such as The Pillars of the Earth and The Evening and the Morning. Here are Ken's reflections.
When I was writing The Evening and the Morning, I found it quite difficult to get hold of details of everyday life in the 11th century. So I went to Bayeux to look at the tapestry, and of course, it was a treasure chest for me. It has something like 58 scenes of everyday life. The variety of stuff is terrific. We see a two-story house, quite posh. And the staircase is on the outside of the building. We see people having lunch and we can look at the cutlery and crockery on their table. Turns out they used knives but not forks. This kind of background detail is very important for me as an author because it creates authenticity in the novel. Writing a historical novel, I think you have to assume that people were fundamentally the same 1,000 years ago as they are today. Their lives, of course, were completely different, and that's the fascination of historical novels. But they must have had the kind of hopes and fears that we have, and they must have worried about love and marriage, feeding their children and raising their children. People with the same drives as we have, and the same feelings as we have. But the story is about how they cope with a completely different world, and I think that's the fascination of it. If you don't get tickets, if you can't get tickets to see it in the British Museum, go to the Reading Museum, where there is a good copy. Really, the only changes they made was they took out the rude bits, you know, naked people and so on. But otherwise, these Victorian women embroidered a pretty accurate copy of the Bayeux Tapestry. So for a year or so, there will be two Bayeux Tapestries in Britain.
Well, thank you very much indeed to Ken Follett for those wonderful reflections. And just to say, yes, Nick will be at the British Museum, where we're broadcasting from tomorrow morning.
It's 28 minutes past eight now. Jonathan's back with the latest on the sport. Hi, Jonathan.
Thank you. Yes, another summer transfer window, another record spend by Premier League football clubs to the tune of £3.46 billion. That's a threefold increase on the total amount by clubs spent 5 years ago. Just 5 years ago, it feels like a parallel universe where a cost of living crisis just doesn't exist. So who are the winners and losers of this latest window? The BBC senior football reporter Nizar Kinsella hasn't slept because he'd been doing the maths the last 24 hours or more. Morning.
Morning. You all right?
Yes, but are you... And who's good in terms of who's got the biggest deal?
Well, the biggest deal was the Enzo Fernandez deal. It happened on deadline day. Remarkably, £300 million worth of deals happened on deadline day. And he was £125 million of it, a joint record. And it was a transfer window of records. So, yeah, Manchester City getting Enzo Fernandez from Chelsea was the biggest one.
And any other, well, plenty other notable deals. Which sort of stood out to you?
Well, there was five deals that were over £100 million. So,
which is almost the going rate now, isn't it?
It's the going rate for top in the Premier League anyway. So Bradley Barcola to Liverpool from PSG. That was £123 million. That was the second biggest. Then you go down the list to Elliot Anderson to Man City from Nottingham Forest. Aston Villa's Morgan Rodgers going to Chelsea. That was a similar fee, £117 million. And then there was Sandro Tonali going from Newcastle to Tottenham. And Tottenham were one of the big spenders.
I was going to say, who were the biggest spenders then? Does it tally with their league position?
Not really. It tallies with the need to sign players. So I think a lot of that's around the change of managers. Nine clubs changed their managers this summer. So Tottenham were one of those. They needed a lot of players. They were third. Then it was Chelsea. They made over £300 million worth of deals, but they did bank over £500 million in sales. So that was a world record, we think. And then Manchester City were out on top, who've got a new manager and changing their club for, you know, after Pep Guardiola left in the summer.
Among the biggest spenders were newly promoted Ipswich Town. What does that tell us about their hopes, and brackets fears, and also the power of the Premier League?
Yeah, so I think what's happened is the bottom of the Premier League has a lot of money as well. So, and that's the big difference from the rest of Europe. And these clubs like Ipswich Town, they can spend at the level of a Champions League club. They can spend £30 million on a player. And that's the kind of money that teams like AC Milan spend, in Juventus, the top of Italy, the top of the other leagues. And we've seen that, you know, the English Premier League, they've spent more money than the other top five leagues combined. So that's Germany, Spain, Italy and France. And I think that that has a lot to do with teams like Ipswich spending so much.
What about deals which didn't happen? Clubs feeling sore, for example?
Yeah, well, I think on deadline day, the Arsenal fans wanted their big forward. They didn't get that. Manchester United as well, they were looking at fullbacks and didn't get that. So there's a lot of this longing feeling that fans have, and other clubs, despite the spending, some fans want their teams to spend even more. So, yeah, there is that. But I think that those clubs are also sometimes the ones with more stability, the ones that haven't changed their manager, like Arsenal, who are the Premier League champions.
Let's see how it goes. We'll see the power of these signings and the title race for the next eight months. Liz Kinsella, thank you very much indeed. Just before we go, Britain's Arthur Ferry's debut at the US Open lasted one match, beaten in straight sets last night by the 13th seed Lorenzo Musetti. The men's top seed, Alexander Zverev, needed five sets to win his first round match. Today, Katie Balter, Jacob Fernley and Toby Samuel all due to play coverage from 5:30 BBC Sounds.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. Just after 9 o'clock this morning on Radio 4, it's Sideways. Here's Matthew Syed.
You may know someone with a PhD, maybe even two. But later this morning, I follow the extraordinary journey of a man who, after dropping out of primary school, went on to study 16 degrees in a range of subjects at the world's top universities: Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, Stanford. It raises a question. What should we do with a lifetime of accumulated knowledge? What does it mean to truly know something? And what is a path to wisdom? Join me, Matthew Syed, for Sideways, this morning at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Just some of the small questions there. All still to come, but for now you are listening to Today, so keep it here with us on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. It's 28 minutes to 9, and now a summary of the news with Alan Smith.
13 Iranian ballistic missiles have been intercepted by Jordan as Tehran says it has launched a new wave of attacks on US military bases across the Middle East. Kuwait says it's also responding to Iranian attacks. In southern Iran, the Red Crescent says five people, including a child, were killed when shrapnel from a US strike hit a house. US Central Command says civilians were not purposely targeted. Commercial airlines and insurers have been warned to avoid Russian airspace, with President Zelensky saying Ukrainian drone attacks are making it increasingly unsafe for civilian aviation. In his nightly address, Mr. Zelensky said the skies over Russia were becoming too dangerous for passenger aircraft. President Putin has accused Ukraine of state terrorism. The Alzheimer's Society is calling for an 18-week target for dementia diagnoses. The charity says families are currently left waiting months or even years for answers, which is affecting people's work, finances and mental health. And more than 1,100 bodies have now been recovered following last week's flash floods in Nepal. Almost 4,000 people remain missing. The United Nations says its focus is moving from search for survivors towards relief and recovery.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It is just 26 minutes to nine. Let's pick up on that lead story from Alan there. What is happening in the Middle East with our international editor, Jeremy Bowen? There's been this significant escalation of attacks between Iran and the US. And Jeremy, perhaps you can bring us up to date. Why is the war flaring up again?
Well, it's because the status quo isn't sustainable, because both sides seem to believe that they have the upper hand. Iran is not going to give up control of the Strait of Hormuz willingly, and the US is not prepared to accept that. It was, of course, open until the US and Israel attacked Iran on the 28th of Feb. So giving in to Iran on this equals a defeat for Donald Trump. The US believes it's got Iran on the ropes, its economic blockade causing a great deal of damage, which is correct. But incorrectly, it believes it's going to cause the regime to buckle. And the Iranian regime believes that they can last it out, that petrol prices in the US aren't falling. And actually, you know what? Both sides might be getting it wrong, because while the Iranian regime correctly believes it's in a fight for its existence, Donald Trump isn't prepared to accept the costs, as he'd see it, of backing down. And so where does that leave us? Well, diplomacy, not happening right now.
In hard-headed terms, Jeremy, what will it take? In the end, it will be some form of diplomacy, but what will it take? What do both sides need in order to de-escalate and in order to say that this conflict, which has been going on for 6 months now, is actually going to come to an end?
Well, the opportunity, however flawed it may have been, was the Memorandum of Understanding, which Pakistan, Qatar and others helped mediate back in April, where it was a way of putting it on hold, really, and some concessions being made and then a chance for negotiation. But neither side trusts the other. Neither side is prepared to negotiate because it thinks that the other one is just going to be lying to it anyway. And so, therefore, diplomacy's come up against a brick wall. And there's also there are two, you know, obdurate characters here. One is the men behind the Iranian regime who are running it now, who are way less cautious than the old leadership that the Israelis and the Americans killed at the beginning of the war. And also, Donald Trump cannot accept that his very rash decision to attack Iran in search of a quick victory has been a strategic disaster for the US. And the only way to reverse out of it is to offer Iran some things which it didn't have before the war. So that's where we're at. And, you know, this is a very disordered and turbulent world at the moment. There's a major war in the Middle East, another in Ukraine and Russia. So this is not going away, because we're in an international system where might is much more important than rules and diplomacy.
Though the US's stated aims for why they entered into this conflict changed a bit, they evolved a bit in recent months, to put it mildly, one thing they were pretty consistent on is that they did want regime change. Has that at least been achieved? And what's actually happening in terms of who now governs Iran?
No, regime change has not been attained. Donald Trump has at times tried to claim that it has been because there's a different guy at the top, so therefore the regime has changed. No, the regime in Iran is an institutionalized system. It is not one-man rule. And so that means that while the system is still there, there are other people running it, and those people look at the caution, actually, of the former supreme leader, the man who was killed, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, on the 28th of February, and they say, well, you know, that didn't work out. The way to do this now is to stay being very aggressive, stay pushing forward, exact and impose costs on America's allies in the Gulf. And for Gulf countries, the current status quo is not sustainable. The Americans are claiming that some tankers are moving out of the Strait escorted by the U.S., and the evidence is that not nearly as many as they're suggesting. So we're in a situation right now where there's a dangerous and unsustainable status quo, where it's going to flare up into exchanges and violence. And if you had to bet on anything, you'd probably bet on it getting worse in the absence of a diplomatic solution.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, thank you.
It's 22 minutes to nine. Despite record investment in clean energy, global emissions still aren't falling. A new report from the Energy Transitions Commission, a group that calls itself a global coalition of major power and industrial companies, investors, environmental NGOs and experts working out achievable pathways to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees by 2040. This report from them says the world remains on course for around 2.5 degrees of warming, with rising demand from heat waves, industry and AI data centres absorbing much of the new renewable power coming online. What is there to be done? Lord Adair Turner is a crossbench peer and the co-chair of the Energy Transitions Commission behind this report. Good morning.
Good morning.
You've described the energy transition as unstoppable in some sectors. Of course, there's solar, batteries, electric vehicles. There's a lot of fast progress going on, but global emissions still rising.
Well, that's absolutely right. It's a sort of paradox. It's a mix of very, very good, much better than we expected, and bad. You know, the progress of the collapsing cost of solar panels, batteries, EVs, and the spread of solar plus batteries and to a degree wind and EVs across the world is far faster than we expected 10 years ago. And some of these trends are now unstoppable. Solar plus batteries is becoming a cheaper way of producing electricity around the clock, 24 hours a day, than coal-fired power stations in many parts of the world. The whole world of a road transport will eventually electrify, and if anything, it's accelerating. But there are other sectors of the economy which we are not managing to reduce the emissions of. For instance, in the UK, it's in residential and commercial heat. And there are some areas where the 2020s have been a disaster. We have not made progress that we would said we would make in reducing the methane emissions from oil and gas production, and we have not put a stop to deforestation. So it is a mix of some extraordinary technological progress, but some failures, and the net effect, sadly, is that whereas the world said it was going to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade, at the moment, the best estimate is that we're heading for 2.5 degrees centigrade warming by the end of this century.
Unless what? What can be done?
Well, what we need to do is reinforce policies across the world, and that means somewhat different things in different countries. In, for instance, China, where the Energy Transition Commission is working very, very closely with, for instance, the China iron and steel industry, one has to move on from the great things that China's doing, for instance, in road transport, and really start drive down their huge emissions in iron and steel production in cement. In India,
just in terms of you're about to cross around there in terms of what different countries need to be doing, but I suppose at the heart of the question really, or the heart of the answer is about whether you think with what you've studied that these governments can be held to do this in some way, whether you have faith that what you've just described in China can happen.
Look, we are working very closely with the Chinese Iron and Steel Institute, which has the responsibility from the Chinese government to get to net zero by 2060. And they're determined to do it. So China will get to net zero by 2060. Now, the difficulty is at the moment, the path they're on is not fast enough. So we've got to persuade them to go faster while also sticking to our own commitments. We've also got to, one of the crucial things we've got to do is help mobilize finance for areas like Africa, which have a huge opportunity with the new technologies to simply skip a generation and forget even going through the fossil fuel stage and move immediately to solar plus batteries plus EVs, etc. So it is different things in different countries. I mean, if you're asking, you know, am I an optimist? I think one's got to try our best possible. I don't think there's any chance of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade. I mean, we're going above it already. But I do think we can still limit global warming to below 2 degrees centigrade with policies which we can take and we can agree. And we've just got to try and take them individually and agree them as much as possible with other countries as well.
When will we know if we're going to miss it, if you see what I mean? Like, when will it be too late?
Well, it depends what you mean. I mean, let's take 1.5 degrees centigrade. I mean, 2024 was more than 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. This year, maybe. It looks highly likely that 27 will be. And the World Meteorological Organization says there's a 70% chance that the average from 2026 to 2030 will be above 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. And nobody who does projections thinks we can limit global warming in 2050 to below, say, 1.65 degrees centigrade. So let's be blunt, that target has been missed. And that's a sad fact, I think. And for countries like low-lying, you know, island nations in the Pacific, it's a disaster. But I think the crucial thing now we've got to do is work out what we have to do to deliver
well below 2 degrees centigrade, or say a 1.8 degrees centigrade limit, which is still possible, and where the technologies are giving us the tools to achieve that if we only put the policies in place.
Well, let's see. Lord Adair Turner, trying to remain an optimist there, a crossbench peer, co-chair of the Energy Transitions Commission. Thank you.
16 minutes to nine this morning on Radio 3 Breakfast. Tom McKinney's guest was the legendary trumpeter Maurice Andre. Just after 9 o'clock, hear Andre in Telemann's Trumpet Concerto, one of the works most closely associated with his remarkable career.
There you go, because that was an important link for you to do, Amol, as we say in the trade. The end is near. Not your eventual end, I hope, but the time here. last morning, Amol, presenting the Today programme. And of course, as you would expect, there's been a beautiful compilation put together of your finest moments. I personally have greatly enjoyed working with you, Mr.
I was
Warden.
Against this montage, you know that, don't you?
I don't think you were. You've not heard it, I don't think.
I certainly haven't.
One thing that's got past you. OK, well, there are many and varied passions of Mr. Rajan. We've reflected some on the programme. I don't know if we've done this that much, but we're going to do it now. Not least your love of a certain musical genre. We do need jungle, I'm afraid.
Wicked, wicked, jungle is massive. Wicked, wicked, jungle is massive.
Some rise by sin and some by virtue fall, so said Aeschylus in Measure for Measure. He might have added that others get to the top through sheer longevity. Andy Burnham is one of those. He was part of New Labour. Our thoughts are ours, their ends, none of our own. So says the player king in the play within a play in Hamlet, a profound meditation on the gulf between our private thoughts and their real world consequences. Privacy is enjoyed. Hello, it's 9 o'clock. This is an extended Today programme on BBC Sounds and BBC Radio 4 with you live through to midday. Britain has voted and Sir Keir Starmer will be our new Prime Minister. In a speech to supporters, he said this moment offered our country hope.
We can look forward again. Walk into the morning. The sunlight of hope.
OK, have you all got your phones on you right now? Can you pull them out and do you know how to check your screen time? Come on, I'm going to do it myself, and I'll be completely honest. I'm going to try and work it out. Okay, mine's pretty serious, and I'm going to go last. So what's your screen time saying? Sophia?
2 hours and 14 minutes.
Faith?
1 hour and 15 minutes.
Do you know what, guys? My daily screen time average, I'm actually ashamed to say, is 5 hours and 2 minutes. What do you think of that? Alex?
I'll say... don't know how to explain it. I have mixed feelings because you can do many things with a phone, so you don't know if you're doing it for good or doing it for bad.
It was while you were in prison that James's parents, David and Joan, took the decision to establish contact with you because they had all these unanswered questions. They wanted to connect with you and they wanted to reach out to you, didn't they?
Yeah, I think, well, they realised that me being in prison didn't actually make them feel any better and they knew I was going to get out. And what actually mattered to them was that I was aware of the impact and the harm that I caused and that whether or not I could answer their questions as to what happened on the night, you know, try and find some sort of meaning or make some sense of what happened and express the harm and to make sure that, like, I, you know, hopefully didn't be one of those people we've been talking about, which is the reoffending. After some exchanges through a mediator, I answered all their questions and then they asked me a follow-up question, which was, Jacob, what are you going to do with your life? And just that act alone literally led to me sat here before you and a play on in the West End. Having the people who I'd caused such tragic harm to even take an interest in me made me want to take an interest in myself.
Presenting with Amol is unlike presenting with anybody else. It's not just the pink shorts, so striking when he walks in the office, or the insistence that there are three tea bags and three sugars in every stewed cup of tea, or scripts that are as likely to quote Milton as well as Mill. No, what makes him different is the energy, the enthusiasm, the intellectual curiosity. When I was a kid, there was a great comic I loved called Look and Learn. Amol has always been one to look and listen and learn and to help those who switch on to the programme to do the same. We'll miss you, Amol.
Given you're called GB News and it's a news channel, do you agree that one function of journalism is to apply scrutiny to power?
Of course it is.
Then why on earth have you got serving politicians presenting news programmes? Chat shows, debates, podcasts, that's all very different. News programmes is a specific thing, and they're not generally former MPs, so Nigel Farage is, they're current serving ones.
No serving MP hosts a news bulletin-based programme on GB News. What they do is absolutely permitted under the Ofcom rules. And if Ofcom, obviously Ofcom is currently looking at this, if that changes in the future, then obviously we'll look at it.
But you must have a pretty low opinion of journalists if you land a scoop with the Home Secretary, as you have done with Suella Braverman, who's given an interview to Lee Anderson, and you think the best person to interview them is Lee Anderson, who's her own party's deputy chair. He might be a hugely estimable, he might be a hugely impressive bloke, but he's not a journalist. And if you're a news programme, why don't you do the humble thing and get a journalist to interview the existing Home Secretary?
Oh, Amal, this is where you're missing the whole point of what GB News is about.
We are filling
a gap in the landscape. We are not journalism for journalists. We're journalism for people.
You know, with young people, you've got to give them opportunities. They're going to fall off their bike.
If I may say, you had a couple of high-profile failures or things not working out as you'd want.
Yeah, but that's part of life's journey. I think we're quite critical of the younger generation. You know, I hear them called snowflakes, and that's in part because we're not allowing them the opportunities to go and do things and to fail and learn from them and bounce back. So we've got to create a better environment for our young people. And as I said earlier, then they have to also step up. It's a dual thing. It can't be that they sit there and just complain about everything. They get one shot in this world. And I had a great coach in Terry Venables who always said, this is not a rehearsal.
This is it.
So go for it in life and do the best you can.
And the Sun reports that Strictly Come Dancing has been plunged into turmoil after the presenters Tess Daly and Claudia Winkleman stepped down in what it says was a secret pact made a year ago. BBC bosses have vowed the show must go on, according to the paper, which names Holly Willoughby and Fleur East among the stars tipped to replace the departing duo. Amal, have they called you?
Well, yes, they said that they... They wanted a show all about drum and bass, and I said, I can't accept drum and bass. We need jungle, I'm afraid. It's 11 minutes past six.
If that's not an in joke, I don't know what is. Amal, it's Justin here. Just to say, I will hugely miss coming into work with you in the early morning, particularly because you often wear shorts and a T-shirt, and that is unusual and enjoyable. You are, it is fair to say, no John Timpson. You've been a massive, massive benefit to this programme. You've brought a really wide range of interests, most of them centred, it seemed to me, on cricket. But that in itself was a good thing because we didn't have enough cricket enthusiasts before you came. More than anything, you've been a sympathetic, amiable colleague, and hugely, hugely of benefit to the audience has been your interest in the world, the whole world, the world of philosophy, the world of thought, and we're going to miss that enormously. Good luck to you then in the digital world, wherever that is. We'll be following your progress with interest.
I mean, it's really boring being a writer. You just sit in a room in your pants, you know, for years, looking out the window, hoping to see something exciting. So working with other people really cheered me up and continues to do so.
You're rather piercing the illusion of this heroic, romantic creature with nothing more than their brain and a pen, committing great thoughts to participate in these wonderful canons that shape our culture. You've rather undermined that for us.
It's a great job being a writer. I would recommend it. I mean, it's not much work. You get paid very well, and lots of people want to have sex with you. I recommend it to anyone.
It's not often that a guest comes into the Today studio who is indisputably the best that there has ever been at what they do, but the thing about cricket is it is a numbers game and the numbers don't lie. 704 wickets, that's 100 more than the next fast bowler, at an average of, remember?
No, I've no idea.
Come on. Of course you know, 26.4.
Honestly, no idea.
26.45 in a 21-year career with 188 test matches. It was long before the end of that career this summer that Jimmy Anderson was commonly described not just as England's best current bowler, but as the greatest of them all. And he's come into the studio because he's written...
Amal, I will miss you. I'll miss you, first of all, as a listener and the way that you bring so much knowledge and curiosity and creativity and care to everything that you do on the programme, and the amount of research that you put in and the way that you do things properly and well. And so we all come out of them having learned a little more. But I'll also miss the way that you are. You're a good person. You come in the morning, the bits that most people don't see, when you've had no sleep, but you're still smiling and rallying the team and offering hot drinks. And all of that is every bit as important as what you see front of house. So thank you for being a good colleague and a good person. And we will miss you, but we also wish you every single bit of luck for the next journey.
Indeed, you do. I can echo Anna's comments there, not least because I can't accept a tea from you because it has three sugars in and three tea bags.
Far too many.
And you're always not sleeping, but you're always still smiling, which is a joy. I did hope you would sleep last night, and you've reliably informed me you didn't.
No, I didn't. I'm feeling really nervous.
You're not going to crush the pips today. I know you're not, and I know you want to say a few words, but we did all want to say how much you've been a great colleague, a good friend. You've thought about things, as people have said, a lot. You care an enormous amount about cricket, which I now have to because of my son, so thank you. And, you know, I think you're also somebody who's got great verve, so I think you're going to be fantastic in whatever you do
next.
Not
to try and turn the tables and interview you, because why would I do that? But do you think I've made a terrible mistake?
You have mentioned that question and thought throughout the morning.
The people in the gallery, I just think, oh, God.
We have just been joined, and you're lovely. Children are here, and lots of your colleagues, and we're all here in the gallery, which you can't see, so we have to paint some pictures with words this morning. And you also make an effort to always smell nice, so I'm just going to say, Radio, you can't sniff it, but if you could, Amol's made an effort.
I smell fantastic. Well, it wakes me up in the morning. Yeah, look, the boss class have come as well, have you noticed?
Yeah, I have. I'll try not to just carry on broadcasting, shall we say. We're live, what can they do? But Amol Rajan, good luck, your final few moments on the Today programme. It's been a pleasure to share the studio with you, and that's not the end, but keep going and tell us more.
Thank you so much. That is basically it for me. I promise to keep this brief, and I promise to speak really slowly. So after more than 1,000 hours, hundreds of pips, a few crashes, it is time to say goodbye. It has been such an honour sitting in the studio with you, Emma, with all the presenters, but above all with the amazing team behind the glass. And in being here, I've accumulated some very, very big debts that will never be fully serviced. So please, please forgive these very brief thanks. I wanted to say thanks above all to you, of course, for your friendship and forbearance. I hope you know how seriously we take your time and trust. To the incredible producers on Today and across BBC News, to all of my incredible heroic colleagues who are here today over the past decade. In fact, you are the best in the business, and we are so incredibly lucky to know you. To some of the very, very special people watching from the gallery to date, to Claire, we adore you. Thank you for everything you do for us. To my kids, Winston, Jamaica, Loveday and Nesta, hello. You can see me here. Yeah, there you go. You are the light and the love in our lives. Sorry for all of the drop-offs I missed. I promise I'm going to make it up to you. To my extraordinary wife, Charlotte, who's also here, thank you. You have made it possible for me to be a dad and to be here and to be me. Finally, to my mum, who's also here, the best of humanity, and to my dear dad, who lit my childhood and ended it by his untimely departure shortly after I began on this programme. You know, when I was a boy, I was a great one for heroes. Strong men in the arena who profoundly inspired me. Men like William Shakespeare, Bertrand Russell, Bob Marley, Shane Warne. Alas, I didn't turn out to be much of a playwright, philosopher, reggae icon, or twirlyman. And anyway, as you get older, you come to realise that it's the people much closer to home, the people in the gallery, that are the real heroes. But there was one hero who seemed ever present when I was growing up, and who I have perhaps had, or may yet have, a little more success in following. It was with the spirit of Del Boy that I turned up at this great and noble institution, and it's to the spirit of Del Boy I return. Thank you to all of the amazing people behind the gallery. Thanks to John Sullivan for this one, and thank you for your time.
Suitcase from the van, 'cause if you are the best ones, but you don't ask questions, then brother, I'm your man. 'Cause where it all comes from,
freedom is a mystery. It's like the changing of the seasons and the tides of the sea. But here's the one that's driving me berserk. Why do only fools?